You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Flashpoints, locking arms with the Brown Revolution, fighting back against 50 years of violent racism against farm workers and their families. We'll feature an excerpt of the powerful documentary Food Chains about the ongoing struggle by farm workers who put the food on the tables with abundance and then can't even afford to feed themselves and their families and get deported if they protest or complain. We'll also have more on the impact of ongoing racist sweeps by ICE in California, and we'll get a visit from best-selling investigative reporter Greg Palast. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is a very serious show for a number of reasons. It's the last, we're at the end of the fund drive, and we have a huge responsibility. We actually have to raise $17,000 in this hour, $17,000 to get us over the $600,000 mark. Yeah. We need to make $700,000. We might not make that, but if we can get into the $600,000 area, we can make it up with a few days promotion. We can pull it out of the fire, but we're going to need your help. So I'm letting you know, you heard all kinds of gifts, premiums. It is available. All the stuff is available. But what we're also going to do is we're going to fight back. We're going to continue our coverage of these sweeps that are taking place. Jefferson Beauregard Sessions shows up in California the next morning. They're sweeping moms. They're ripping moms out of the arms of their children. First up with me is Miguel Gavilán-Molina. He's a senior producer here on Flashpoints. And Miguel is a former child farm worker who worked in the fields with his family. Miguel, you were listening. I don't even think you could look at the pictures, but you were listening.
You're right.
To what was going on there with that mom being ripped out of her daughter's arms. What was going through your mind?
Initially, shock. And then an immense surge of anger, rage, and then finally unbelievable sadness. And right before the show started, and as you saw me and you, Frank, me pacing and breathing, and I mentioned to Frank, you know, that I was doing a little bit of Parahasamama Yogananda, a little yoga breathing meditative state, just to be able to calm myself enough to talk and not get choked up. It's a hard one, Dennis. I as a child, witnessed Operation Wetback as they took my father. And it traumatized me for life. I'm still dealing with the trauma, the anger, the rage, and the inability to do something. So I dedicated my life.
Yeah, to be clear, your father was beaten unconscious out of your mother's arms.
Taken away from us, yes. And taken by the security forces and INS during Operation
Wetback. Out of the Bracero program, a similar program they want to bring back now. But
well, yeah. And you know, he was taken. And I remember, I'm a child. I'm not even, you know, I'm just 6 years old. And I'm seeing this. I remember trembling and sweating and cold. And my mother was knocked unconscious. My baby brother's crying and my father was taken away. I grew up feeling always under terror. An airplane go by, a police car go by, anything that looked like the authorities. And that's just been my life, Dennis. I've always have walked with looking over my shoulder, fearful, the fear that was instilled in me by security forces of the INS and police and whatever else was out there, National Guard. That's why to date I have that fear. And anyone, you know, they grew up in my era, you know, knows that. You know, it's always forever the fear. And I say to myself, here we are, Dennis, in the land of freedom, in the land of the brave. That's what's broadcast around the world. But yet there's no freedom for me and my people. I was born on the U.S.-Mexican border. I was born in Douglas, Arizona. I have had to show my papers. I can't even tell you how many times I've had to show my papers as an adult, as a teenager. Why? Because I'm brown? Because I look like a criminal? I look like an illegal alien? There's no such thing. So how do I feel? I feel angry. And I ask, where is the real Christians? You know, where everybody, even the stranger, is welcomed. You know, where is Larry King? Where is Oprah? Why aren't they talking about this on national news? When children who are U.S.-born citizens are getting their parents taken out and ripped from their arms as criminals. My father was not a criminal. That woman who had those, who was taken away from her kids, she's not a criminal. Why is it that brown people are looked as criminals? You know, where there's a history here that goes on for decades, and it has to stop. We're trying to create a new world. Cesar Chavez awakened a whole society. Yeah, we might be slaves in the fields. We might, you know, harvest and earn the most dangerous industry in this country. We feed a nation. You know, we're worthy of respect and dignity. Why is it that, you know, brown people are subjugated to this? Profiled, you know, targeted because of skin of their color? That has to end. We're all humans, Dennis. I'm sorry. I got a little carried away.
You were saying, Miguel, the other day, in terms of as a kid being in the fields with your family, that they would spray pesticides while you were in the field. And you...
Yeah, Dennis.
You had such little knowledge that the kids used to describe...
Dennis, you know, the airplanes would walk by and spray you. And it was just one of those things of work. You're going to get sprayed at some point. And, you know, we were kids. We didn't know. There was no science telling us of the dangers of toxic pesticides. Nothing. This was before Cesar and Dolores and the United Farm Workers came on the scene. And I remember looking up in the sky, closing my eyes. We'd all close our eyes and stick out our tongues. That spray tasted like lemon drops, you know, those hard candies. You know, citrusy lemon drops. And we close our eyes. We didn't know. We didn't know the dangers. But Cesar awakened us and awakened the nation, awakened this nation that we are human beings and we deserve respect and dignity for the contributions we've made in the development of this Southwest California all the way to Texas and to Florida, how we've enriched this country with our culture and traditions. And yet, we as a whole population within this country have been criminalized. I'm a citizen. I've been stopped. Every time I'm stopped or pulled over, Dennis, I'm asked for papers. Why? That isn't right. It's illegal. I'm a U.S. citizen. So, yeah, I'd like to say that I'm going to chill down a little bit here. I get a little excited. I had to meditate.
I just want people to understand the commitment. You joined this team.
Yes.
Many years ago.
2003.
And the first thing you did is went across country.
On the Freedom Ride. Reenactment of Martin Luther King's Freedom Riders.
But this was the beginning of that Brown Revolution.
Right.
That's why you joined the team.
Exactly.
And that's why we have vowed to continue our coverage of the story, which is huge now, and the suffering continues. I want to, Miguel, bring Free Will and Frank Sterling into this discussion because we've got a film. By the way, again, folks, there's all kinds of premiums that you can get. You can get the Perry package. You can get the Chomsky speech. You can get the combo Perry books with the Perry CD and the Chomsky CD for $350. That would be a good one. Perry books, Perry CD, Chomsky CD of New Speech, $350. You can get for $850 the big ol' combo. Perry books, Perry CD, Chomsky CD, Palace DVDs, Palace book, Food Chains DVD. You can get all of that for a $850 contribution, any level. But folks, I can't, I don't, I won't. I don't want to spend a ton of time on premiums. I'm telling you, this is our last day, and we are tasked to raise $17,000. $17,000. We're going to need to kick it to do that. The number, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. You can be damn sure that we're going to watch what goes on. Sessions, the flaming racist, shows up in California and sweeps, and mothers are getting ripped out of their kids' arms. No, 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 no. We're not turning our back on that. That is a story that we are going to stay with from top to bottom. You know what we're talking about. 1-800-439-5732. I'm sorry, Frank.
Hey.
And by the way, you're about to tell us about a film that people can also get if they want.
And yes, that's why it's very important that we talk about this film tonight. All the things we're talking about, the immigration, the deportation, being sprayed in the fields, it's covered in this film, Food Chains, and it really shows the other side of the story, how much we rely on folks to pick our food, and what we do to them in return, the disrespect that we show them and how people are treated. And I brought along a couple clips, Dennis, if you guys are ready to hear about these clips.
Let's start with it. You've got a tickler for the film.
And so it's the trailer from the film. This film's produced by Eva Longoria, Eric Schlosser of Fast Food Nation, directed by Sanjay Rawal. This is a great documentary. It chronicles the coalition of Immokalee workers and their fight for one penny more per pound of their tomatoes. One penny more per pound, and they would not even talk to them about giving that to them. But the film also covers harassment and slavery in the fields. It covers immigration and farm labor, what we're highly reliant upon, but still we treat these folks with disrespect and indignity. But we have the trailer all queued up, and it kind of gives us a little outline of the film, and then we'll be back to speak with you right after this.
I still believe agriculture is the backbone of America. And when you have an industry as big as agriculture, you've got to pay attention to the labor force.
The history of farm labor in the United States is a history of exploitation.
The plantation and the ghetto were created by those who had power, both to confine those who had no power and to perpetuate their powerlessness.
All my life, I have been driven to overthrow a farm labor system in this nation that treats farm workers as if they were not important human beings.
These people have suffered tremendously and grown much more slowly economically than any other segment of our society.
The appalling conditions of farm workers moved my brother to crack down on the abuses. But too little has changed over the years. Their working conditions are deplorable, but most of them are afraid to demand fair treatment because they know they'll be fired, blacklisted, or turned over to immigration officials.
It is terribly important that we understand how in the year 2008 slavery can exist, and how workers can be treated as badly as they are.
Most people have no idea that they're connected to this system every time they buy fresh fruits and vegetables.
All the fresh fruits and vegetables in supermarkets arrive there via the supply chain, an intricate system of distributors, farmers, and farm workers. Supermarkets set all the rules in the supply chain: the prices consumers pay, how farmers grow their crops, what these crops can look and taste like, and ultimately, how much money is left over to pay workers at the bottom of the supply chain. While all the workers who pick their produce live below the poverty line, these massive corporations generate $500 billion a year in the U.S. alone.
And the entire supermarket business goes out of its way so that you're not reminded of where your food came from.
If a handful of companies decided that they wanted to eliminate poverty and exploitation among farm workers, it could happen very, very quickly. Pennies more on purchases of fresh fruits and vegetables could eliminate this problem.
Powerful sounds from the film Food Chains, directed by Sanjay Rawal, produced by Eva Longoria. and Eric Schlosser, an amazing film that really, well, say a little bit more about the film and where it goes.
Really what it does, Dennis, it at the same time, it chronicles the fight for a penny more per pound periodically throughout the show. They go on a hunger strike outside of the biggest supermarket in Florida, Publix, and they're refusing to even speak with them while they're hunger striking right outside their doors.
For a penny.
For a penny more per pound, which would actually double their wages, because right now they're getting about a penny per pound. And, you know, if we were to be added, the supermarkets have passed the penny per pound down to us, it'd be about 85 cents per year for us to increase on our produce. And so they fought this the whole time. So it chronicles that, but at the same time, it goes through different accounts of what happens to people that work in the industry, the tomato industry, the wine growers in Napa, and how the farmers there, the field workers, they can't even afford to live there. A bunch of them are camping out down by the river and then going to pick grapes and harvest crops there, and they can't even live nearby in a shelter. They're basically camping in tents. And so it chronicles that. It chronicles the abuses in Florida, where they had uncovered a slavery ring where people were being locked in a U-Haul trailer overnight and then dropped off at the fields in the morning.
And we've seen tragedies around that. So we've got another clip here?
Yeah, we do. Up next, we have one. It's about harassment and slavery in the fields, and it really chronicles also the woman's plight in the field. And it documents on the average American worker, woman in the workplace experiences, 25% of them experience sexual harassment in the workplace. But in the fields, it's up to 80%, almost four times. And with no recourse, because if you complain, what's going to happen? ICE is going to come take you away, or you won't even have a job to make that little bit of money. So we do have another clip here lined up. You notice Bernie Sanders in there. We heard him already. Cesar Chavez. This film's full of great people talking about this, but the thing that's most important, it gets down to the workers, and we get to hear the voices of the workers and their plight from their own mouths, and it's all in the film, Food Chains.
Let's listen.
When people have been in poverty, they don't feel as able to voice their resistance to things because they've already been beaten down in a class system which has disabled their voice.
Farm workers who complain face the very real threat of being fired and slipping further below the poverty line. Because this industry doesn't effectively police itself, government oversight is essential, but is sorely lacking. Florida has only 14 labor inspectors, for example, to monitor over 40,000 farms.
It is an impossible task to take care of every instance of abuse that goes on in the fields.
It's like you have all the crime that you always have in New York City, and you have two or three cops on the entire beat. They're not going to be able to do anything. And that's what it is in the fields today. It's like a New York City crime spree without any cops.
Only a fourth of the workforce in agriculture is women. Usually the farm owners, the supervisors, the managers, they're all male.
Women are exposed to harassment, not only from the employers, but also from their own coworkers. For many years, abusers have not been punished, because women have been afraid to report the crimes.
Sexual harassment is a problem for women everywhere. 25% of American women report experiencing sexual harassment in the workplace. In the isolated environments of the fields, however, this figure is believed to be closer to 80%.
Look, it's insane that anyone's experiencing sexual harassment, but to look at those numbers is an indication of what happens when we have women who are poor. They have children and families to feed. And so they can be easily harassed because they need the income. For a woman in the field to be able to voice what's happened to her is crucial. But then to see repercussions and to see somebody being held accountable for that and to see justice. We need systems that are more efficient and that get to justice in a quicker, more immediate way.
35 years, there has been interest from select U.S. senators in investigating the physical and economic exploitation of farm workers. But there's been no legislative action as of yet. An informal hearing was held in 2008 to give farm workers a voice in exposing the worst human rights violations, like modern-day slavery.
Today, we are a very long way away from Immokalee, Florida. Thankfully, due to the dedication and hard work of a number of people, including the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, the conditions that exist in the Florida tomato fields have begun to come to light. I'm very pleased that Lucas Benitez, a co-founder of the coalition, could be with us today to shed even more light on the subject.
Buenos dias.
Good morning. It's an honor to be here testifying in front of this committee and an establishment as esteemed as the U.S. Senate. I thank you for this opportunity. But the reason I am here is very troubling. The sad fact is there is slavery in the U.S. fields in the 21st century. Others will speak in more detail about modern-day slavery, but I assure you that the seven cases discovered in Florida's fields are just the tip of the iceberg.
Between 1997 and 2010, more than 1,200 farm workers were freed from slavery in southern Florida. Some of the workers were U.S. citizens. And in 2007, a slavery ring was discovered in Immokalee.
In the last slavery case, it happened right here, only 9 blocks away from the main parking lot, but nobody knew.
Pero nadie sabía.
Two brothers, Cesar and Giovanni Navarrete, ran a slavery operation, luring poor farm workers with the promise of food, housing, and jobs. Unbeknownst to the workers, the Navarretes were charging an exorbitant amount for room and board. Over several months, the workers accumulated large, false debts and threatened to leave. In retaliation, the Navarrete brothers beat them and kept them confined at night to the back of a U-Haul truck. After a year of slavery, one worker noticed a small hole had formed in the roof of the U-Haul. He managed to push through and escape.
One of them decided, either I look for my freedom or I die here. So he got the courage to escape and find help.
Senator Sanders and I happened to be in Immokalee, Florida, this January, when the U.S. Department of Justice released its indictment in the latest slavery case there. Here are some details from that case. The defendants have been accused of threatening, slapping, and kicking farm workers, chaining them to a pole, beating them, locking them inside U-Haul trailers, keeping them in debt, and forcing them to work for free. The indictments read like something you might see in the year 1868, not the year 2008. These abuses are un-American, they are unacceptable, and they must stop. Thank you.
Law establishes that slavery is a crime. Law establishes that sexual harassment is a crime. But we still see all of these things happen. Why? It's not a question of how beautiful it sounds in the books. It is a question of how effective the enforcement mechanisms are.
And you're listening again to excerpts from an incredibly powerful film called Food Chains. Now, understand, we're sharing this with you in the context of the visit by the Attorney General Jefferson Beauregard Sessions, who came here to threaten brown people. The day after he was here, well, it was going on before he got here, but the day after he was here, there were sweeps. There were many more people arrested, many more threats taking place. This is a nothing less than a white supremacist trying
every way possible to disempower, undermine, and endanger, threaten this community. And it is the key civil rights issue of our time. It is the responsibility of all of us to understand what is going on here. Jefferson Sessions has been fighting against civil rights for his entire career. Now he comes here and he's threatening to sue public officials and he's leading raids, which are now ripping people off the street. On this show, we're going to cover it. We've been covering it for years. We're going to continue our frontline coverage. Miguel, I'll give the number, 1-800-439-5732. There's a traffic jam in my heart because I am sidetracked, Frank and Miguel, because the issue itself is so compelling. The story is so important. What Sessions is doing by taking this hard line is the few rights, the few possibilities for people to defend themselves are being taken away. So they're pushed further into the shadows, more vulnerable, more easily abused. That's the action and that's the result of Jeff Sessions coming here to California. And it's very ugly. We share this film, and we share this work with you because that's what we believe in. Miguel, maybe you can jump in here.
Sessions is on the orders of the, the Waffle House in D.C. That's he's getting his supremacist orders to do what he's doing. But I think people here in California, we're creating a new world. We're the most populous state in the union. We're the most diversified state. And, you know, communities of color here have been prospering, contributing to the culture of California, and it's all of us. And, you know, the officials that have been elected, those policymakers that we have voted into power, into their post, you know, have stood up, you know, from Jerry Brown. I've never seen Jerry Brown so angry as I heard him a couple of days ago, angry. You know, and Kevin De Leon, the Latino Legislative Caucus, the Legislature of California, the Senate of California have said, no way, bring it on. They're going to have a difficult time here. But I think ultimately we have to stop these raids. They're kidnapping and holding people hostages in what most people call detention centers. They're really concentration camps. People have to begin to look over the veil, over the illusionary, you know, blanket that the mainstream media paints. There is a human rights crisis happening right now. Citizen children are being terrorized for life and traumatized by having their parents, you know, kidnapped, you know, from them in the streets. You know, kids are afraid to go to schools. You know, my dad might get arrested if he drops me off at school. Now people are talking about being afraid to go to hospitals. This has to stop.
All right, Miguel, we're going to keep doing this story, and everybody knows why. Yeah. Yeah. And everybody knows who they hear on these airwaves from Arturo Rodriguez, the president of the United Farm Workers, to Pablo Alvarado, the executive director, a regular guest on this show, executive director of the National Day Labor Organizing Network. We take our show. We broadcast from these day labor centers. Right. We've done that over the years. Right. We will continue to do that. Absolutely. That's how close we are. This film, Frank, I really appreciate that you brought it to us on this day today. If people want to get a copy of the film, they can get it for a $60 contribution, 1-800-439-5732. We have, by the way, a $5,000 match.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
A couple of generous folks got together and said, okay, this is the last day. This is the last hour. We want to give them a match. Now, I'm trying to raise $17,000, but I'm honestly, going through this with you, Miguel, and the way you feel these things, and I myself am heartbroken from seeing this mom being dragged away from her kids in a suburban street by who was it, Frank? Were you Did you show me the video where people put side by side this mom being arrested next to a clip of a Nazi SS Gestapo troop arrest, a Gestapo arrest,
basically escorting them away, and just they're in a truck, they disappear,
drive up, take the people out of their loved ones' arms and disappear. That's America. That's San Diego. That's what we can't tolerate. That's what we are devoted to reporting on. You can get a copy of this film if you want for a $60 contribution. You can get, by the way, if you have a little extra money, say you have $850, you can get this film, the Chomsky speech, the Palace DVDs, plus the Palace book. That's also Palaced with that other guy. It also comes with the Perry books and the Perry DVD, the 10-hour retrospective of Robert Perry. So if you want the massive Flashpoints package, you can get it for an $850 contribution. Or you could just give us $5,000 because, folks, we need every dollar. If you believe in our message, please forgive. Oh, please, I apologize. Forgive my inarticulateness today. But I, you know, dealing with this, talking about it, you could talk statistics all day, right, Miguel? But if you've seen it, if you've witnessed it as you have in your own house, or if you see it happening in the street, it's a whole different story. One mom being ripped out of the arms of three of her daughters on the way to freaking school in San Diego. Try and imagine that. And it is not getting coverage. The coverage on Rachel Maddow and MSNBC and CNBC and Fox News. I have to say that their coverage is they're covering Trump and the porn star. They are covering Trump and the night and day, 3 days in a row. Moms being, which is the story? Which is the story? Which is the real human rights story? Which is the story of our time when it comes to Donald Trump? The porn star or the policies where you're ripping moms out of their daughters' arms? We're asking you to call 1-800-439-5732 because I haven't been doing a good job here. I must not have been because the phones aren't ringing nearly enough. And we really need them to. Just 1 second, Miguel. I'm going to say the number. I swear. 1-800-439-5732. You can do it online at kpfa.org. You can get anything you heard. By the way, they also have the $1,000 mega pack with a whole bunch of speeches, the winter warmer pack. You can get that. The $1,000 pack has An American Struggle, Who Streets, Healing Justice DVD, No Gods, No Masters, Capitalism DVD, Untold Story DVD. That's Oliver Stone. KPFA Winter Speech Pack is in there as well, with Noam Chomsky, Daniel Ellsberg, Richard Wolff, Michio Kaku, the whole crew, all that stuff for a $1,000 contribution. $10, $25, $50, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. By the way, I'm thinking 17,000, and I was hoping this was 11,000, but actually it's $1,028. I've raised so far $1,028, and we have to raise 17,000. I'm going to need a little help, Miguel. We're going to need a lot of help. 1-800-439-5732. I'm going to shut up. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. This is our last day, and we are asking you to pull out the stops because we are way behind, Miguel. I'm sorry.
Yes, we are, but at this point, we really need you to step up and you know, take care of our backs. We're down, and we're going to keep going one way or another. But one thing is clear, that those of you that realize that last century, there was this horrific Holocaust and concentration camps, and people were targeted and rounded up and taken into detentions, into concentration camps. And we know that history. We also saw it here happening to a group of Asian Americans who were rounded up, targeted, and put into concentration camps. You know, and here we are, 2018. A new era, a new millennium, and what are we facing? Concentration camps, hostage-taking, kidnapping. That's what it is when ICE makes a raid. Now, some of you might not fathom that or imagine that, but that's what it is. You don't know terror unless you're a child who's had to witness it. You know, there's a population here that's under terror. We have to somehow take that away, remove that. Not in this country, not in our state. And for those of you that realize the history of the last century or were awakened by the farm workers or by Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movement and marches, I'm asking you, you who had to get to the streets and force this government to change its laws that were inhuman and unright and unjust. That's why civil rights came up, civil liberties, all of those things and amendments were drafted. Well, we're in a situation now. There's a human rights crisis here in California, in this country, called ICE, you know, against the population. And we need your help to save these children so they don't have to grow up traumatized like myself. 1-800-439-5732. We need your help. We need to stop this. If you're not brown or of color, you might not understand what I'm saying. But we can't allow slavery and children that are U.S. citizens traumatized by these inhumane laws. We need your help. This station is in a financial crisis. We're $17,000 under. We might not be able to make our operational expenses or our payroll. I don't care. I will continue this even outside of this station on a soapbox with a bullhorn. 1-800-439-5732. I can't make the plea to my farm worker communities. We don't have the money. But those of you that do and were awakened by Cesar Chavez or Martin Luther or Malcolm X, give us a call. Give us $25, $50. Give up one of your fancy foodie dinners that might be $60 or $100. Give up a few lattes, you know, a month. And send us that money. We need it now more than ever. We have an unbelievable cultural war that's already having a human impact by mothers being taken away. Imagine you as a child having your mother ripped away. How would you feel? How would you respond? 1-800-439-5732. I'm pleading with you. We need your help. Keep this station alive. Keep this program on the air. It's the program here, this station, is the one that gave me a break almost 40 years ago when I showed up, when we were under attack by law enforcement against lowriders, cholos and chicanos, when there was the war in El Salvador, the Contra War, all of that. We were impacted and affected by these policies. Give us a call, 1-800-439-5732. We're your neighbors. We go to your schools. We're part of your community. We feed you. We pick the food. We prepare it. We serve it in restaurants. Look at it. Look at the industry here in California. We're everywhere. We're human beings, and we have a right to be here with respect and dignity. 1-800-439-5732. We got six operators that came in today to volunteer their time. Your donation is tax deductible. All you have to do is press the buttons and say, yes, I will support justice, respect, and dignity to humans. And yes, brown people are also part of the human race. 1-800-439-5732.
1-800-439-5732. That's Miguel Gavilan Molina. My name is Dennis Bernstein in the studio, as well as Frank Sterling. And this is the last day of the fund drive. And you can tell Miguel has been with this program 15 years, and in that 15 years, I have traveled with him to the border
to explore the attacks on indigenous communities that live on both sides of the border, who are being destroyed by what's already going on there in terms of checkpoints and security. We've broadcast from day labor centers in Phoenix, in Tucson. We have been on the ground with the movement. We watched as local administrators in Tucson tried to ethnically cleanse the schools and end the ethnic studies program. We were there. We broadcast with the kids who are being closed out of the classes. This show has fought that book ban in Arizona and in Texas. We are very close partners with the folks that have been fighting that battle for many years. We have been there on the front line. We believe that this network and that this radio station is a voice for the voiceless, a voice for the disinherited, for the marginalized, for the undermined, for the disrespectful, for those folks who don't have the money to buy the punch. 1-800-439-5732. Now, there are many premiums. I'll just go through it once. Please forgive me. And then I've got Greg Palast standing by, and I hope he is still with us and waiting patiently, because we're going to need him. We're going to need him. What we have, speaking of Greg Palast, is the what we're calling the Palast Pack, which is the Palast, the best democracy money can buy. It's the book, it's the film, it's the and it's a conversation he had with David K. Johnston, a 2-hour hilarious, incredibly powerful conversation. And Greg holds David K. Johnston, shall we say, honest. Anyway, we're getting to that. 1-800-439-5732. I can't finish a sentence here, and I'm worried because it is, in fact, the last hour. We are way behind, and I have the slightest idea how much money we've raised, but I know we haven't made that $17,000 yet that we're going to need to raise. We've got the $850 pack with Palast and the Perry books and the Perry 10-hour retrospective and the Chomsky speech given last week and the Food Chain documentary and the whole. You can get all that for $850. You can give us $25, $50, $75, $100, whatever you've heard on this fund drive is available to you now. You can get the winter 218 mega pack for $1,000, the winter warmer pack, $500, whatever pack you get, pack it in, stand up, and speak out for Free Speech Radio. Greg Palast, sorry for keeping you waiting. We appreciate having you. And, you know, where you picked the story up is we've been talking about brown people being swept off the streets, and you've been talking about brown people having their rights and their voting rights swept from out from under them.
That's right. In fact, give me 100 seconds, dear listeners, and I'll tell you why you want to support KPFA. Okay? Because I'm going to tell you right now something you ain't going to get on MSDNC or National Petroleum Radio. Ready? Here goes. You can take your count the seconds. All right? Today, this week, Wichita, Kansas, there is the trial, the voting rights trial of the century, which is Kris Kobach, Trump's vote thief in chief, who said that there were millions of aliens on the voter rolls. He has actually blocked 1 in 7 new voters, and I kid you not, 1 in 7 new voters, accusing them of being potential aliens because they cannot prove citizenship to register to vote. If he wins this case, this will be like the ID cases. This will absolutely guarantee lock in Donald Trump's reelection. It will guarantee lock in GOP congressional race. Now, if they get elected, I have no problem. The problem is blocking, again, 1 in 7 new voters. 1 in 7 will be blocked if Kris Kobach wins this case in 30 GOP states. What is he saying? You're going to have to prove you're a citizen. And guess what? We're not Red China. We don't have citizenship cards. The only thing that counts for citizenship, Dennis, is number one, a passport. Now, who has passports? How many cholos have passports? You know, come on. Who has the passports? The second is young people. Half of the people that were blocked from voting are under 25 years old. And how do they vote? Those are the blue voters. Same with the poor voters that don't have passports. They're the blue voters. overwhelmingly, these are Democratic voters. They don't want them to vote, and they're using this alien scare that millions of aliens are swimming the Rio Grande and registering to vote. And you heard from Manuel the terror that people are going through. They're not going to start. People who don't have papers are not registering to vote with their addresses to be picked up. The idea is completely insane, and Kris Kobach is on trial right now. He's been sued by the ACLU and the League of Women Voters. Kris Kobach calls them the Communist League of Women Voters. This is the voting rights trial of the century. If we lose this one, we're in trouble, and you will only know about it now because you heard it on KPFA. You're not hearing it nowhere else, and you'll get the real information, including a cartoon about alien voters, if you call the number and get the – what's the number for the Palace PAC?
Okay, so here – the number is 1-800-439-5732. Let me give the details on the PAC. It's, again, the number –
1-800-439-5732.
Correct. Correct.
Okay.
1-800-439-5732. So the in terms of the Palace PAC, it's the best democracy money can buy. That's the case of the stolen election. That's the film.
It's a DVD. That's right.
That's a $100 contribution. You can get the book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. If you want a lot more detail, The Case of the Stolen Election by Greg Palast, that's $75. If you want to get Greg Palast and David K. Johnson, it's worse than you think. This is Greg talking to Johnson about his new book. That's a two-hour talk DVD, really funny. And you can get the DVD, that's a great, both DVDs, that's the documentary and the conversation, the Palace book for $200. You can get, and there's a bigger package. If you have a little more money, you can get all the Palace stuff with the discussion with David K. Johnson, along with the brand new speech by Noam Chomsky. You can get the Bob Perry retrospective, the 10-hour retrospective, the two Bob Perry books, and the documentary we were highlighting earlier, Food Chains. You can get all of that for an $850 contribution, and you do it by hitting the numbers 1-800-439-5732. We're in a $5,000 match, Greg. We're trying to match $5,000, which means every dollar we get now, the meaning is doubled. 1-800.
Okay, so then that's easy. It's the 800. Hey, KPFA. This is Greg Palast. Listen, you're going to get the brand new movie. This is the post-election edition of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, The Case of the Stolen Election. This is exactly how Trump stole it. In fact, it won't even go to print till next week. And you're going to get that as soon as it gets off the press. So you get the DVD, which, by the way, has extras about my investigations in Michigan and Georgia, how they stole the election, the congressional race in Georgia, which I did for Democracy Now. You get the real, full, complete story in video. And you get the film, for those, even though it's a documentary, it's featuring Shailene Woodley and Rosario Dawson, Willie Nelson, who's playing a stoner musician, believe it or not, Ed Asner as Santa Claus, Ice-T and Richard Belzer from Law and Order, they're in there, and cartoons, because we do want to show you alien voters. We have cartoons in there of a spaceship landing with aliens coming out voting. So Kobach might be right. There probably are alien voters because we have the pictures in our film. 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Get the book. That also includes inside it the Ted Rall comic book, which is called the Crypt of Democracy, and that's the 46-page comic book. Inside the book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, that's a new edition about how Trump stole the election. You get the DVD, you get How Trump Stole the Election, the book with the comic book. You get my talk with David K. Johnston. It's worse than you think what the Trump administration is doing to America, and that's for a minimum donation of Bubkiss, how much is that?
You can get the whole the Palace pack for $200. $200. 1-800-439-5732. The Palace pack for $200. 1-800-439-5732. We are trying to raise a great deal of money here. What are we looking at now? Okay, we're at $3,300. Thank you to Art Devatidis, John Griffin, Madeline Monica, Layla Means, Ronald Harris, Hoytis Roland, Diane Mahoney. Thanks to all of you for standing up for Free Speech Radio, for putting your money where your beliefs are. We've got, Greg, this is our last hour. We've got 12 minutes to go, and we are pretty short of our goal. I'm trying to get us over the $600,000 mark. Let me just explain. That means instead of we're at $3,300 now, we need $15,000. 1-800-439-5732. We can do this. We can do $1,200 a minute. We have enough listeners to do that. If people want to stand up now and really pull out the stops for Free Speech Radio, you can do it by hitting the numbers 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. You can do it online safely at kpfa.org. But whatever you do, do it. And now, in this last day, in these last minutes, if you've got a little extra, we could use a little extra. If you've got $500, if you've got $1,000, couple of you out there have 5,000 that you could kick over with and you wouldn't miss it at all. Please do it now. 1-800-439-5732. Get the big, giant, big ol' combo. It's called the big ol' combo. It's the $850 pack. All the palace material, plus the brand new Chomsky speech, the Robert Perry 10-hour retrospective, the two Robert Perry books, Food Chains documentary, all for an $850 contribution. If I could get 10 of you to do that, that would be very helpful. 1-800-439-5732. Of course, $25, about 200 of you with $25, that'll work. 1-800.
And we can do that.
Go, Greg, go.
Yeah. Saying, please, I want you to call. You can get the brand. We're just going to print it next week for KPFA. We have KPFA in mind, the latest update of the best democracy money can buy, how Trump stole it. It's the case of the stolen election. And you get all these characters. And you'll laugh at the beginning, you'll cry at the end, or I'll pay for your therapy. That's your guarantee from me, Greg Palast. Call that number right now. You're going to get the film. You're going to get the book, which includes the comic book by Ted Rall. And you're going to get, in addition, me and David K. Johnston, ripping the pants off the administration of the Trump. Now, you want to call 800-439-5732. I'm volunteering. I'm donating. Please volunteer and donate with me. 800-439-5732. This is Greg Palast saying, dial, hey, KPFA, and get the Palast pack. I know, Mom, I want you to buy a couple more of those packs. Ready? It's the DVD, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, where we jump. I literally jump Chris Kobach in this film. We go undercover, and we get the billionaires behind Trump, because Trump is not a billionaire. He just plays one on television. I expose the guys who are really pulling the strings on the puppet orangutan. There are puppeteers. Everyone's shooting at the puppet. I'm going to show you the puppeteers in the film and in the book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. You can get both with the David K. Johnston talk. You get all three of those, and then in it is the Ted Rall comic book, by calling 800-439-5732. This is Greg Palast asking you, please, come on, call right now, 800-439-5732. Hey, KPFA, I'm doing this because I believe in this station. I can't tell you how many times I've broken news on flashpoints that no one in the mainstream media would touch the real stories. What happened to Hugo Chavez? That the mainstream media was reporting that he resigned as president years ago. And I got a KPFA in the middle of the night from London saying,
kidnapped.
He didn't resign. He was kidnapped. It was Dennis Bernstein that broke that story.
I think I was half asleep. London. Listen, Greg, we're over $4,000, but we have a long way to go. Let me just interrupt for a moment here and remind people that you can get anything you've heard during this fund drive. We've got a marvelous $850 Flashpoints pack. It's the big old combo with the entire Greg Palast package, the Robert Perry's two wonderful books, Robert Perry's 10-hour retrospective, the Chomsky speech, very powerful speech, Food Chains, the documentary. You can get that for $8.50. We have other, we have a $1,000 mega pack. If you've got $1,000, just call 1-800-439-5732 and ask what's in that. There's a winter warmer pack for $500. Call 1-800-439-5732. We're trying to get over the $5,000 mark at this point, and we are a bit far away. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. The last day of the drive, it is 5:54 in the afternoon. We have 6 minutes left to go. We need the big spenders to stand up now and make a big difference. If you've got a little bit of extra money, we are hoping that you will step forward this very moment and make that big difference, make that big contribution. Step forward, take an action that nobody makes you take, but that your mind, your heart, every cell in your body says it is good to support a radio station that is not owned by a corporation. It is good to support this invisible university in the airwaves, this canary in the coal mine of electronic disinformation. I mean, really, seriously, all the networks for the last 3 days have been reporting on a porn star. And there are sweeps. There are Nazi-like sweeps going on across the country. Hundreds of people are being swept out of their families, and Rachel Maddow doesn't think this deserves the 99% of the time that she's given to the prostitute over the last day or so. I mean, seriously, seriously, seriously. Trump, what do we care at this point? At this point, we want to know who he is destroying systematically. That is what we have been reporting on in terms of these sweeps across the streets. If you
by the way, Dennis, I'm going to add that if you get the Palace Pack with David K. Johnston, this film was made only for Pacifica. You can't get it on Amazon, so don't go looking for it for 99 cents. It ain't there. The 2 hours of me and David K. Johnston literally going into the heart and guts and heartless soul of the Trump administration, into the details, but with humor and enlightenment. You'll enjoy it, but it's part of the Palace Pack. You get the brand-new DVD film, the update, which will be ready only next week. It's not even out yet. Next week.
All right. All right. Now, Craig, I've got to interrupt. I'm sorry. I've got 4 minutes. I'm getting a message here. 1-800-439-5732. We're up to $5,258. We have 3.5 minutes to go. We're going to have to do a lot better. I want to thank you, Kathleen Kesterke. Thank you, Daniel Borgstrom. Thank you, Rebecca Alvarez. Thank you, Sandra E. Drake. We thank you so much. Thank you, Marav Freya. Thank you so much. Maria DeGruy, thank you so much. Virginia Fernley, thank you, thank you, thank you. But right now is the reckoning. Right now, we're up to 5,258, and we were hoping for 17. Now I'm going to have to settle for 10. And to make 10, we're going to have to burn up the lines of free speech radio. Here is the number, folks. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 5,000 is a nice start. Are you out there? Do you have a little extra? Will you step forward and give us a little extra? 1-800-439-5732. Is there somebody out there that's got $5,000 that wants to jump this big time right now? Is there somebody out there who wants to step forward and say, oh, yeah, I'm going to make a difference. I'm calling right now. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 5732. I am asking you to pull out the stops for Free Speech Radio. You can get the Palace Package. You can get anything you heard on this drive. But what you get, what you really get, is the open flow of information. You get a station and a network that makes love to the First Amendment. We do believe in freedom of speech. We don't always get it perfect, but we do not restrain it. 1-800-439-5732. I am hoping by now that we were over 6,000, but I have not heard from the phone room. I hope that's because they are very, very busy. Where are we? We're at 6,300 with 90 seconds to go. 1-800-439-5732. 6,300 with 90 seconds to go. Stand by. Stand up. Thank you, Gene Bernardi. Thank you, Parusad Gita. And we understand that we got an anonymous thou, so that's taking us up there, 6,300. We're going for 10 thou. We've got 1 minute to go. Greg, thank you. Miguel, thank you.
Yes,
everybody, and thank you. I don't have time, Greg. I'm like...
$5,000. I'll be in San Francisco in April. I'm taking you and your friend to dinner.
All right. That's for a $5,000 contribution. 1-800-439-5732. Dinner with Greg Palace. Give us a $5,000 contribution. 1-800-439-5732. I've got about 20 seconds. 1-800-439-5732. We're over 6,500. That's beautiful, but how about a little bit more, folks?
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Noam Chomsky explains more of the ways the wealthy and powerful first make you pay for the knife and then stab you in the back. I hope you'll stay tuned. This is the third of our shows, devoted, at least in part, to Noam Chomsky's excellent conversation with Ralph Nader. The conversation took place in May 2017. Back in May, a film had just been released on Chomsky's ideas, and also a book. Both are titled Requiem for the American Dream, 10 Principles of Concentration of Wealth and Power. And as George Carlin reminds us, they call it the American Dream because you have to be asleep to believe it. But back to Chomsky. I gather that the book and the film are like an updated version of that nonfiction bestseller of the 1530s, Machiavelli's The Prince. But the audience is different. Machiavelli is advising rulers on how to rule. Chomsky is advising the ruler's subjects on how our rulers are actually ruling us. Chomsky identifies 10 principles by which our rich and powerful nullify democracy. How they keep themselves rich and powerful by keeping the 99% poor or relatively poor and absolutely powerless. In the two previous installments, we heard Chomsky and his interviewer Ralph Nader discuss these 7 principles. 1. Reduce democracy. 2. Shape ideology. 3. Redesign the economy. 4. Shift the burden. 5. Attack solidarity. 6. Run the regulators. And some of part 7. Engineer elections. The discussion actually weaves back and forth a bit among these points. When the previous installment stopped, Chomsky and Nader were talking about how the financial fat cats got away with economic murder after 2007. Or more precisely, how they got away with criminal plunder. We'll pick up there, and then move on to Principles 8, 9, and 10. They are keep the rabble in line, manufacture consent, and marginalize the population. How to turn a democracy into a plutocracy in 10 easy steps. From May 2017, here are Noam Chomsky and Ralph Nader.
The much worse 2007-2008 crash, nobody was punished. There were fines. In fact, big fines, like the J.P. Morgan Chase, biggest bank, I think it had something like a $13 billion fine. But when you take a look at it, first of all, it's tax deductible. Secondly, they have all kind of ways around it, and their profits are huge. And they ended up, the banks that were responsible for the crisis ended up richer than they were before. Now, there was an attempt at some kind of control afterwards, the Dodd-Frank legislation, to try to prevent, at least limit, the next major crisis. But that's now being dismantled by the Trump administration, which is exactly as you say, is a kind of caricature of the deregulatory efforts to free the corporate sector from any kinds of constraints so the wealthy can continue to enrich themselves, you know, beyond the dreams of avarice. And of course, it's exactly as you said, the cabinet appointments, it would be almost comical if the consequences weren't so awful, but each one is in the hands of someone who wants to undermine the functions of that cabinet. We see it already in the legislations and executive orders that are being sneaked through. A lot of it's Paul Ryan's initiative, the more savage fringe of the old Republican Party, policies which are undermining what's left of workers' rights, of occupational safety rights, of the horrible health program that they're pushing through, basically amounts to a big tax cut for the rich at the expense of the most vulnerable parts of the population, who by design of the program will be thrown out of the health system. These are systematic policies to try to carry the more savage fringe of the neoliberal programs into effect, into implementation. Incidentally, with regard to the financial institutions, it's worth mentioning that they survive on a public subsidy. There was a very significant study of the International Monetary Fund a couple of years ago, which investigated the profits of the major U.S. banks, J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, the others. And what they found is that their profits almost entirely rely upon a tacit government insurance policy, what's called informally too big to fail. Now, that doesn't just count the periodic bailouts. It means all sorts of other things, like, for example, they're able to get cheap credit. They get inflated credit ratings because it's understood that if they get into trouble, they'll be bailed out by the taxpayer. There's an incentive to undertake risky and hence, at least in the short term, profitable transactions in the knowledge that if they collapse, which they will, the taxpayer will be called upon to bail them out. The business press, Bloomberg, Business Week, using this study, estimated the annual subsidy at about maybe $80 billion or more. These are really predatory institutions. And we should add that that subsidy is peanuts as compared to the taxpayer subsidy for the energy industries, for agribusiness and other major industries. So all the talk about free market and so on is substantially a joke when you actually look into how it works. This is the taxpayer subsidizing their own repression by supporting predatory institutions who act for their own benefit, of course. That's what they're for. And in ways which often harm the public, as these statistics on income distribution show, on declining wages, on declining democracy, and so on. And it's not just the United States.
That's true. I noticed that Principles 7, 8, and 9 have a very logical link. Engineer elections, Principle 7, keep the rabble in line, an old-fashioned word for the masses of the people, Principle 8, and manufacturing consent, Principle 9. And what you see around the country is not only are the candidates in the pockets of the paymasters, mostly from the corporate world, but they've gotten the people to vote against their own interests because the choices are so narrow between the Democratic and Republican parties that people end up, for example, if they can't stand Hillary Clinton, they vote for Trump, often in a very impulsive manner. And the worst example of that manufacturing consent that is hardly ever mentioned is access to the courts. They've actually persuaded a majority of people that there are too many frivolous suits and wrongfully injured people get too much money, when the facts are that less than 2% of wrongful injury ever get into the court to begin with, and that we're using the courts at a lower level in terms of civil lawsuits than was the case per capita in 1840. And so part of the manufacturing consent is, I guess, turning people against their own interests by throwing them up against the wall and having a media, mass media system that does not demonstrate what's going on in the country, in effect entertains and deceives. So how do you weave all that together in terms of a controlling system by the few over the many?
Well, there's an interesting image that's been proposed by some of the analysts and investigators who've done the most significant study of this paradox, as it's sometimes called, that people who are being undermined by political decisions are voting in favor of the candidates who are undermining them. Arlie Hochschild is one of those who's studied this in some depth. In
Strangers in Our Own Land. That's right. Her book.
It's very
interesting. And what's going on in Appalachia now.
Yeah.
Yes.
Same thing. And the image that comes out, which the people themselves accept, is it's an image of people standing in a line. We're standing in a line. Behind us are our parents and our grandparents who worked hard and tried to fulfill the American dream. They had traditional families. They did the right thing. They were religious. And they got ahead. So each, they were moving along ahead in line. That's the American dream. All of a sudden, the line has stalled. We're standing in line, and it's stalled, or maybe even declined. Up ahead of us, there are people who are flying into the stratosphere, you know, unbelievable wealth. But that doesn't bother us because the propaganda system, which we internalize, tells us, okay, that's the American dream. They're working hard and getting ahead, mostly a joke, but that's the image. What worries them is the people behind them. And now we get the scapegoating aspect of the propaganda system. Ronald Reagan and his fairy tales about welfare mothers, by implication black women, rich women driving in limousines to the welfare office to pick up your hard-earned contributions for Social Security or whatever, that story. So the people behind us, according to the imagery, are worthless, they don't work hard, they're the wrong color, and so on and so forth. And what does the federal government do? The role of the federal government is to help those worthless people behind us get ahead of us with food stamps, with affirmative action, with welfare programs. So that's the role of the federal government. So therefore, we should hate the government. Not hate the concentrated wealth, which is corporate power, which is determining these policies. We don't see them. They're not part of the system. We see the federal government helping the worthless people behind us get ahead of us while we are stuck in the line. That's the imagery. And that's a pretty effective way of controlling people. And I suspect we're going to see more of that in the near future. Trump's promises. You know, I'm going to bring jobs back. We're going to have a steel industry. Of course, they're not going to be realized. And what happens when they're not realized? We should remember that quite a few of the working class Trump voters voted for Obama in 2008. They believed, or at least put faith in, his promises of hope and change. Well, they pretty soon found out there was no hope and no change, so they were disillusioned, angry, ended up with their voting for their class enemy, who was shafting them at every possible moment. Well, what happens when these people realize that the promises once again were a delusion? At that point, the government, the ruling powers, corporate, private, and state, are going to be forced to turn to more extreme scapegoating to direct the anger and disillusionment somewhere else, not to us, but somewhere else. Who's the someone else? Well, there's a long history of this. The most vulnerable parts of the population, or even of the vulnerable foreigners. And that could turn out to be pretty ugly. I mean, this is the moment to act constructively to try to prevent all of this. And there are ways of doing it. Again, the Sanders phenomenon, it was pretty remarkable. As I say, it broke from over a century of political tradition. And in fact, thanks to Fox News, we know their polls they ran, that the most popular political figure in the country by a huge margin is Bernie Sanders. All of this indicates opportunities that are available to turn the tide if those opportunities are taken. You have to understand what's happening and then act, you know.
And one of the ways consent is manufactured is to divide and rule so that people turn against each other, red state, blue state, left, right, conservative, liberal, and don't focus on the oligarchies and the plutocracies who are basically focusing people's attention on where they disagree with each other, like reproductive rights, school prayer, gun control, and not where there's a huge left-right consensus on many of the economic issues, the civil liberties issues, the cracking down on corporate crime, the opposition to crony capitalism, what we call corporate welfare, even criminal justice reform. So this divide and rule, I saw how this worked, Professor Chomsky, once when I read that Senator James Inhofe, Republican of Oklahoma, who thinks climate change is a hoax and now has enormous influence in the Senate and over the EPA on climate change policy. He was once asked, how do you win these elections, Senator Inhofe in Oklahoma? And he smiled and he said, simple. It's God, gays, and guns. And that sort of sums up that divide and rule situation, which distracts people away from, let's face it, the few who are oppressing them economically and all other serious ways that impair a decent livelihood, fulfilling their human potential, and passing on something better to their children and grandchildren. So in your last 10, principle 10, is marginalizing the population. Would you elaborate on that?
Yeah, you're exactly right. The problem for concentrated power, corporate and state power, the problem is the general public. The general public is always an enemy of concentrated power. We saw that, for example, in discussing the quite similar Powell Memorandum and Trilateral Commission crisis of democracy. They're concerned with the public. People aren't being indoctrinated enough. They're getting too active. We have to marginalize them somehow. We have to break up the kinds of institutions, like particularly labor unions, in which they can join together to act to pursue their own interests. Incidentally, the same is true of political parties. The United States doesn't really have political parties. That's been true for a long time. It has candidate-producing elites. So you can't be a member of the Democratic Party the way you can be a member of the Labor Party in England, for example. What you can do is show up every once in a while and put a mark in a ballot where they tell you, here's a possible candidate. That's quite different from a political party in which people actually participate in forming the policies in advancing them and so on. There's a little of that here, but not much. But any organization that brings people together is dangerous. They have to be separated and marginalized. And your point about the common beliefs across the spectrum on crucial issues, that's essential. So, for example, the things you mentioned are quite accurate, and there are plenty of others. Like, for example, raising taxes on the rich. Now, that's been a popular demand for as long as polls have been taken, you know, 40 years more. Right now, it's the same across the spectrum. Meanwhile, taxes on the rich go down. That's one of many indices of the separation of state corporate power from the popular will. And the same is true on a host of other issues. So take one that's really primary in people's lives and is right on the front pages now, health care. Take a look at polls over a long period. There's been very substantial support for what every other developed country has, some form of national health care. The U.S. health care system is an international scandal. It's over twice the per capita costs of comparable countries and has some of the poorest outcomes, mainly because it's privatized. Highly bureaucratic, inefficient, very costly, in the hands of institutions like insurance companies, which are not concerned with health, but with profit and so on.
It's basically, Fred Chomsky, a pay-or-die situation. Look at the drug price escalation in recent years. I mean, far higher than any place in the world, and we're the ones who subsidize these drug companies through the National Institutes of Health and give them all kinds of free clinically tested medicine with no royalties and no reasonable price provisions. As you say, a majority of the people, latest Pew poll show, they want full Medicare for all, everybody in, nobody out, free choice of doctor, comes in half the price per capita, that's what the figures are in Canada, and saves tens of thousands of lives.
You know, that goes way back. So at the end of the Reagan administration, for example, about 70% of the population thought that the right to public health care should be in the Constitution, and about 40% thought it already was in the Constitution. People don't know what's in the Constitution. They just assume it's whatever makes sense. And this makes so much sense, it must be in the Constitution. When Obama put through the Affordable Care Act, of course, there was some talk about a public option, meaning essentially Medicare for all. And about almost two-thirds of the population supported that. But it was just dismissed. The United States is, I think, the only country where the government is forbidden by law from negotiating drug prices. So, say, the Pentagon can negotiate for paper clips or whatever, but the government cannot negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies for drug prices outside the Veterans Administration. That's one reason why we have highly inflated drug prices way beyond other countries. There are public attitudes on this. There was a Kaiser poll right at the time of the Affordable Care Act, which found that about 85% of the population were opposed to this, but it didn't matter. It didn't enter the discussion and debate. I mean, those are crucial issues, and these are things on which, if you take, say, Trump voter, many of the Trump voters and many of the Sanders voters, you'd find that they have pretty similar concerns. There is a real possibility of putting together a progressive coalition which will be concerned with rights, justice, access to the courts, decent jobs, progress, creating, not fulfilling, the partly mythical American dream. That can be done. We have the resources for it. We have opportunities. And there's an enormous struggle to prevent it from happening by atomizing people in a huge number of ways. One of the ways, incidentally, is just by fostering kind of extreme consumerism, trying to drive into people's heads the idea that the only thing that matters is how many commodities you have. Nothing else matters. Huge amounts of effort are poured into hundreds of billion dollars a year to try to create this imagery. These are major efforts, all aimed at manufacturing consent, subordination, atomization, marginalization, preventing people from joining together to pursue the goals that they do, in fact, want, but aren't being offered to them in the political system, while the main actors are being hidden from concentrated wealth and power.
As a matter of fact, in spite of the propaganda and manufacturing consent, there are huge areas of support from people of different political labeling, conservative, liberal, for civil liberties, for example, for changing the war on drugs, for example, for changing the corporate tax system and those tax havens. Even Ron Paul and Barney Frank got together in the House on the bloated military budget. Polls always start out against these wars of aggression before the soldiers go over there and dissent is shut down. I found in the consumer and environmental area huge. When you get down off the abstraction ladder, Professor Chomsky, you can see where people live, work, and raise their families. The ideology tends to dissipate, and they focus, regardless of whether they're conservatives or liberals, wanting their children to have good schools, drink pure water, breathe clean air, eat safe food. And that's what we've got to provide a cutting-edge movement for, because once that consensus breaks 70% and is supported by left and right, it's politically unstoppable in Congress and state legislatures, and the nature of elections begin changing. Well, before we conclude, we've been talking with Professor Noam Chomsky of MIT, author of many books on power, structure, abuse of foreign and military practices, as well as the need to build our democracy. He's the author of Requiem for the American Dream, and it's based on a film that's getting widespread attention here and abroad. It's also called Requiem for the American Dream. Sometimes the plutocrats and the oligarchs go too far. They cross certain lines that are insufferable even by the established legal order, much less the mass media. What do you think the prospects are of Donald Trump's regime imploding on itself because of its extremism, number one, and its bizarre style as well?
Well, so far, what's been happening is, whether planned or not, I don't know. I presume it's planned. But what's happening is a kind of a charade, which is going on at two levels. At one level, Trump is making one outrageous claim or move after another. So, you know, these millions of illegal immigrants who voted for Clinton, Obama wiretapping his phone, whatever it may be. It's kind of like the birther business in the past. So one after another, the major media, say CNN, the New York Times, what are called the liberal media, I don't think it's the right term, but that's what they're called, they go after him. And so if you look at CNN, it's almost entirely going after the latest crazy thing that Trump did. That's what people pay attention to. Meanwhile, that's used to strengthen his base. He and his, you know, the guy, Steve Bannon, the guys who are running this stuff, can say, oh, you see, the liberals are trying to attack our guy. And in fact, support for him among his base is actually increasing because they see themselves as under attack from the liberal elites who are trying to undermine their spokesperson, their spokesman, by demonstrating the absurdity and falsehood of his claims. At the same time, at another level, we have Paul Ryan and his gang pushing through legislation of the most extreme, savage end of the Republican establishment. Step by step, that's what they're doing, while attention is focused, and here the Democrats are substantially to blame, in my opinion. Attention is focused on other things, which are the one or another outrageous act. Now, it may be that the outrageous acts will be so extreme that it'll implode. But so far, the game is working pretty well.
Noam Chomsky and Ralph Nader in a third installment of a long, brilliant, and eye-opening discussion they had in May 2017. Thanks to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour for the original recording. and thank you for listening to New World Notes. Find us on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. I am Kenneth Doust, and I not only thank you for listening, I also advise illegitimi non carborundum, and I hope you will come back again next week. Till then.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short sighted, narrow minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading. Psychotic, pig-headed politician. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. The show you're about to hear today was originally aired in June of 2010, but is still highly relevant today. So here goes. Today you're going to hear the second and final part of the speech given by Michael Parenti at the Understanding Deep Politics Conference on May 15, 2010 in Santa Cruz, California. That'll be followed by some information on the Department of Homeland Security's fusion centers. So first let me tell you a bit about Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti is an internationally known award-winning author and lecturer. He's one of the nation's leading progressive political analysts. His highly informative and entertaining books and talks have reached a wide range of audiences in North America and abroad. So here's Michael Parenti with the second and final part of his speech.
Here's another thing. For some people, conspiracy theory, by definition, cannot be proven true. Because when it's proven true, it's declared to no longer be a conspiracy theory, but a fact. I've had arguments with people on the phone, and I realized, I said, so then the conspiracy theory does apply. I said, what conspiracy theory? That's a fact. You proved to me that that's a fact. I said, but it's a conspiracy fact. It's people colluding in secret to pursue illegal and unlawful and immoral goals with the intent of advancing the interests of people who are not acknowledging their association to this action. As I've said, and I'm glad to see that Mickey Huff, he made the same point yesterday, but I have said it years ago that I don't have a conspiracy theory, but I do have a conspiracy analysis. And that should be our answer when any work you're doing. When somebody brings this thing up like a little knee-jerk, like a bell ringing, oh, why do you have a conspiracy? And it's not that innocent or all that stupid. It's a very effective weapon. It's a way of putting closure on your investigation or argument. It's a way of delegitimating what it is you have to say by just using this term. The term has become so charged, as I showed you with the Walter Karp one, that even when someone's making it, brilliant conspiracy analysis, he has to acknowledge a distance and say, but this is no conspiracy theory. There are actual conspiracies. Conspiracies exist in the law. In the law, they use the term all the time. It's a feature of law. Here, 2006, a federal court adjudged the major tobacco companies to be guilty of a 50-year conspiracy to deceive the public about the addictive and health-damaging qualities of cigarettes. Millions in the United States and abroad, quote, have died as a result of this conspiracy. But you don't find any tobacco executives in jail. That's another whole question about systemic analysis and class power and such that we might pursue. If we conclude that 9/11 is an inside job, we have to say, why? And I guess there have to have been some books written about that, hasn't it? Why was it necessary to commit this inside job? It was a Pearl Harbor to legitimate an action that followed immediately after. I remember on that same day when the buildings came down, I heard Brokaw on the radio, Tom Brokaw, saying, this is war, this is war. And he kept saying, this is war. I'm saying, no, it's not. It's a building that came down. Here's another one in Missoula, Montana, W.R. Grace. Federal government charges they conspired knowingly to violate the Clean Air Act, knowingly releasing asbestos into the air for us all to breathe. For three decades, Grace kept meticulous records documenting the extreme potency of its asbestos fibers, the ease with which they became airborne, and the decline of the miners' health. Now the people of Libby will have a chance to tell their story. Now, isn't that interesting? For years, they were saying how many were dying and where this was going, knowingly doing that. Here's another interesting story. Two journalism groups did an analysis of U.S. comments by U.S. leaders, top leaders, that effectively galvanized public opinion to engage in war against Iraq in the 2 years following the 2001 terrorist attack, 9/11. And the studies found the statements made, the studies counted 935 false statements in the 2 year period after 9/11. It found that in speeches, briefings, interviews, and other venues, Bush and administrative officials stated unequivocally on at least 532 occasions that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction or was trying to produce or obtain them or had links to al-Qaeda, even though they never came up with a shred of evidence on any of those things. Of course, there you could ask, are these false statements that they were making, were these statements mistaken or incorrect? That's Christopher Hitchens' fallback position on this. They had every reason to believe there were weapons of mass destruction. It turns out they were wrong. They were misinformed, faulty data. They got the CIA to fall on the sword for that one. So was it incorrect or were they outright mendacious lies and fabrications? Well, what do you think? If you think George Bush is just a stupid little doobie-doo-doo, why then they were innocent mistakes. If you think he knows what he was doing, then you know what he was doing. And you don't sound so stupid then. We have today Wall Street conspiracy firms like Goldman Sachs knowingly selling mortgage-backed securities at top prices with full knowledge that they were worthless and walking off with other people's money. Billions we're talking about, billions here. Yet no one has used the word conspiracy yet. You notice that? And in fact, the case against them is a civil case. No one's even being charged with a criminal crime. Should be going to jail. Well, I also want to point out when you're looking at conspiracies that the establishment, the powers that be, the conspirators, those at the top, policymakers, corporate America, all those people, they constantly assume that conspiracies exist when it's their enemies. They talked for 40 years. Since I was a kid, I can remember they talked about communist conspiracies, communist parties all over, communist parties here, communist parties in Hollywood, communist parties infiltrated trade unions, communist parties in policy, communist parties in the peace movement, communist party going to grab your mama, communist party everywhere. I remember that all the time, working secretly with subterfuge and pernicious intent. They consciously operate with conspiracy theories when it involves other people, not themselves. Just this past week, Times Square, an SUV, smoke comes out of the SUV. What did it take the New York Times and the FBI and the White House and the CIA and Homeland Security and all the other guys and the New York Police Department? What did it take them, about an hour or 2 hours, to leap into a conspiracy theory and say, there's a conspiracy here. We've got to find the conspirators. I thought it was a lone assassin. I said, I think this is just a disturbed, lonely assassin guy, like one of those Middle Eastern guys with an accent who can't really get along so well in our society. That's what I said. I mean, he leaves the car, the propane doesn't ignite. It's an amateurish job. And then he's going to escape the country. How is he going to escape it? He takes a mainstream airliner with a no-fly list and all that, and they nail him at the gate there. If you have a conspiracy, you know, list, and people say, he had connections with people in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and in Massachusetts. I said, Lee Harvey Oswald had connections with people in New Orleans and in Dallas, and still he was just a lone, simple assassin. But apparently this is a conspiracy. But you notice they didn't have any trouble. Nobody said conspiracy theorists, yeah, yeah, yeah. They all said, let's find the other conspirators, you see. So these are the ways we can decide how something is a conspiracy or not, if there's been intentional planning. Another way to find out is by monitoring what the conspirators themselves say. Here's a guy you all know, Dick Cheney. When he was vice president of the United States, 2001, quote, we'll have to work sort of the dark side, if you will. We've got to spend time in the shadows in the intelligence world. I mean, who's that? Is that a spooky kook, one of us talking, or is that the vice president of the United States? He's saying it himself. Let me say that again. We've got to spend time in the shadows in the intelligence world. A lot of what needs to be done here will have to be done quietly, without any discussion. It's going to be vital for us to use any means at our disposal, basically to achieve our objectives. That's awfully nice. I'll give you another one. John Foster Dulles. I think a lot of you remember who John Foster... No, well, none of the ladies are old enough to remember John Foster. But some of you guys, along with me, we remember John Foster Dulles. Wealthy corporate lawyer, conservative Republican, Secretary of State in the Eisenhower administration. His brother and fellow multimillionaire, Alan Dulles, was head of the CIA, CIA director. John Foster was keenly aware of the need to stoke popular fears and manipulate people to serve epoche, to serve the few, in order to mobilize support for the enormous costs of empire. And he wrote about it as follows after he got out of office. A lot of these guys, you know, they become a lot better when they're out of office. They start saying certain things and they act human. Jimmy Carter is another example. You know, he starts talking much better. So he wrote this in one of his memoir. In order to bring a nation to support the burdens of maintaining great military establishments, it is necessary to blow up the Twin Towers. No, I made that up. Let me start all over, all right? In order to bring a nation to support the burdens of maintaining great military establishments, it is necessary to create an emotional state akin to war psychology. This is war, as Tom Brokaw said. There must be the portrayal of external menace. Once that ideology has been perpetrated, the nation is, that was my line, ideology perpetrated, quote, this is Dulles, a long way on the path to war. One last quote, David Rockefeller. David Rockefeller, with good reason, during a speech at the 1991 Bilderberg Conference, declared, quote, we are grateful to the Washington Post, the New York Times, Time Magazine, and other great publications whose directors have attended our meetings and respected their promises of discretion for almost 40 years. It would have been impossible for us to develop our plan for the world if we had been subjected to the lights of publicity during these years. Now, someone should deconstruct that last sentence, because the guy is admitting an awful lot. He's saying we could have never gotten away with what we did if someone put the light on and publicized this. I got that from Canadian Dimensions. I'd like to get Gordon Laxer. I'd like to get the original source to make sure that that is, well, then that's an additional, 91 was the year? Yeah, it sounds too perfect. It sounds like he's saying too much. All right, let's strike that one. No, we don't want to get played with and misled. They can bring people and take you all sorts of places. Here's a guy who knows something about government skullduggery and secret planning and conspiracies. A good friend of mine, I was sitting in his kitchen one day. His name is Daniel Ellsberg. And I got it on tape, too. I got this on tape because my son was with me. This was back before my son started doing all his own writing and such. He was doing radio reporting, and he recorded the whole thing. Dan Ellsberg started talking about his years, and this never came out in his biography. His last biography, I didn't see a word of it, so you're getting it. He started talking about classification of documents. Do you know, this is not Ellsberg, this is me now, and I wrote about it in my book, History as Mystery. I calculated the number of documents that are classified every day by the federal government is about 20,000 a day, counting a seven-day week. So, 364 days divided into so many billions. What are they classifying? Well, it's security. They don't call it conspiracy, of course. Dan Ellsberg made the following statement. He said, there are three classifications for what you can see. Like, not only are your documents classified, but you're classified, which shows what you can look at. The first is confidential. The second, more rigorous one, is secret. And the third is top secret. And Ellsberg said to me, he said, there are other classifications that are so secret that you don't even know the classifications. And the public isn't told those classifications. And Ellsberg was in one of those. And they would meet in these little policy confabulations, these little committees, and they would deal with some very incredible stuff. Some very murderous and dangerous and explosive stuff. And Ellsberg said to me, he said, there were two questions you could never ask. If you asked one of these two questions, you would never be invited back into this committees. The first question was, is this legal? They would all look at you and look at each other. And the second question was, is this moral? They would really look at you and say, is this guy too dangerous to have here in this room? And your office would be moved down to the basement, down the hall from the mail room, So that's the question we got to ask. What are they being so secret about? What are they being so afraid about if questions of legality and morality are so threatening? Well, let me end with an anecdote. I remember when the Panama invasion took place. It was with George Bush Sr., the old man. And I said, it wasn't about Noriega being a drug dealer. I said every leader all through Central America, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, they were all involved, and the generals were all involved up to the ears in the drug dealings. And Noriega probably wasn't. But he wasn't cooperating in the war against the Sandinistas. And the Panama military was a left-wing military at this time and was putting in all these kinds of social reforms. That's why they got rid of him, because George Bush is dedicated to an elitist mode of society. A student of mine said, I can't believe that. I can't believe that the president of the United States, that President Bush, would misrepresent and mislead us into a war because he disapproved of what some other leader was doing in his own country. I can't believe that they would use power like that. I mean, he was a sweet, nice kid, And he said, that's the difference between you and me. I have faith in the president. I said, wait a minute. Faith? Is that the word you – I mean, what are we doing here? Politics or religion? What is this? What do you mean you have faith? You mean the way my Italian grandma had faith in St. Anthony? She used to have a little statue with lights. Oh, bella, Georgie Bush, oh, bella, Georgie Bush. He said, well, I trust the president. I trust him. I said, trust? That's another word. What do you mean you trust? We don't trust. Democracy isn't about trust. People didn't give their lives to try to live on trust. Democracy is about distrust. Democracy is about the people mobilizing and challenging and calling for transparency, for investigation, for showing what this is about. No, trust is a blind faith. No, you know, trust is something you reserve for your loved ones or close friends. And even them, check them out once in a while. So even them, check them out once in a while. And so we know what the answer is. The answer is democracy, real democracy, right in their face democracy.
You've just been listening to the final part of a speech by Michael Parenti, given at the Understanding Deep Politics Conference in Santa Cruz, California, on May 15th, 2010. To see the video of this speech, you can go to the website understandingdeeppolitics.org. And to learn more about Michael Parenti and his books, you can go to the website michaelparenti.org. And now I want to share some information with you on fusion centers. Fusion centers were developed by the Department of Homeland Security, and according to their website, state and major urban area fusion centers provide critical links for information sharing between and across all levels of government and help fulfill the key recommendations of the 9/11 Commission. And of course, if you've been doing your homework on 9/11, you know that the 9/11 Commission has not provided us with the truth about the events of 9/11, and many of the 9/11 commissioners have admitted that themselves, along with their chief legal counsel, John Farmer. Author David Ray Griffin has written a book called The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, where he has outlined over 100 key omissions and distortions. The most glaring one is that the commission never even mentioned the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7. So we have these fusion centers set up across the country based on the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission report, which its own members admit is a flawed investigation. Here's more on fusion centers from the Department of Homeland Security website. Many states and larger cities have created state and local fusion centers to share information and intelligence within their jurisdictions as well as with the federal government. The department, through the Office of Intelligence and Analysis, provides personnel with operational and intelligence skills to the fusion centers. This support is tailored to unique needs of the locality and serves to help with classified and unclassified information flow, provide expertise, coordinate with local law enforcement and other agencies, and provide local awareness and access. As of July 2009, there were 72 designated fusion centers around the country with 36 field representatives deployed. The department has provided more than $254 million from fiscal year 2004 through 2007 to state and local governments to support the centers. The Homeland Security Data Network, which allows the federal government to move information and intelligence to the states at the secret level, is deployed at 27 fusion centers. Through the Homeland Security Data Network, fusion center staff can access the National Counterterrorism Center, a classified portal of the most current terrorism-related information. And it shows here on the Department of Homeland Security website that these intelligence officers have been deployed to the fusion centers in Connecticut. According to the Department of Homeland Security's own website, it says the primary mission of the fusion centers is information sharing. Keep that in mind as you listen to this clip of one American sharing her experience with fusion centers. This is Catherine Bleich speaking recently before the Austin, Texas City Council as they consider accepting funding for a fusion center. This audio clip came from the website CorbettReport.org on June 6, 2010. And here she is, Catherine Bleich.
My name is Catherine Bleich. I'm a new resident of the Austin area. I came here from Missouri. I founded an organization in Missouri called the Liberty Restoration Project, and we focus on personal privacy as well as state sovereignty. And I became very much so involved in fusion center research after the Missouri Information Analysis Center in Missouri profiled me as a potentially radical violent militia member because of my political beliefs. So these fusion centers have a very intimate impact on my life, and that put me on a track of in-depth research. I partnered up with, our organization partnered up with TAG, and we've been traveling the country visiting fusion centers and speaking to people in their communities about fusion centers and how they can get involved with them. And thankfully, in Missouri, we were successful in having that report that I mentioned that profiled people like me who support various political ideologies. That was retracted. And we went through 4 legislative hearings with our state legislature in order to get this situation dealt with. And it's an ongoing process. We're still dealing with it up there. I have moved down here, but our organization is still focused on that. Unfortunately, no one's been held accountable for that. Yeah, the director of the Fusion Center, they lost their job, but they got moved to another department. They still have a taxpayer-funded position, and the repercussions of that document are still reverberating throughout the nation right now. So I want to speak to some concerns that I have with this Fusion Center moving forward today, and I want to ask that you all consider the gravity of the vote you will be making. If you do choose to move forward with this, I fear it is in haste, and I feel that you may regret that decision because the opportunity for even more scandal to rock the Austin area is huge. If you consider that in Arizona, we were told by their Fusion Center staff that if you're planning a rally in Arizona, they will run your name through a Fusion Center database with no criminal predicate, although criminal predicate is what they're supposed to be based upon, correct? The Maryland State Police, through their Fusion Center, entered 56 anti-war activist names into a database, a terror database. You have in Oklahoma, we visited them earlier this year, and they said that other than them, there were only 2 other fusion centers in the nation that had privacy policies that were accepted by DHS. So that shows you right there that, you know, the privacy policy that y'all have been working on down here, that's a living document, and it may or may not be as constraining as some of the activists here originally thought, especially considering most fusion centers operate without one. And in the Seattle Fusion Center, there was an FBI analyst who was assigned there by the FBI, but he worked for the State Fusion Center, and he spent 2 years infiltrating an anti-war group to the point where he was managing their databases and sitting down intimately in their meetings. I'm not trying to say that anyone who works for the Austin Police Department or anyone here locally has bad intentions, but the fact of the matter is these fusion centers are riddled just completely with scandal after scandal after scandal, instances of fraud, abuse, misuse. And I think that you all, as the representatives of the people of this community, owe it to them to do them the service of properly vetting this fusion center before you move forward and potentially put people at risk. And it goes further than that. Not only was I profiled for my political beliefs by my government in my state, and I had to fight to have that retracted, but because of that fight, the Southern Poverty Law Center, an institution that does training for Fusion Center staff, now has my face and my name up on their website, a website that is designed to identify people who commit acts of violence and hate and who are racist, and that's not me at all. Those are the people who get paid by the DHS to train Fusion Center staff on how to identify potential threats. Is that what we want to be doing here in Austin? You know, I'm moving down here. I came down here in February. I plan to be a long-term resident of Austin. I left one community that was treating me, I felt, very horribly because of my political beliefs through the use of their fusion centers. I don't want to come to another community like this. And when you consider that you guys do have no refusal weekends where you do take blood from people forcibly, when you consider that just a week ago that grant application still was calling for the Fusion Center to assist in the implementation of rapid inoculations in the case of a mass crisis, it begs me to question, if you're willing to forcibly take something out of my body, how do I know you're not going to forcibly put something into my body? And I don't think that law enforcement or a fusion center have any role in that whatsoever.
Again, that was Catherine Bleich speaking recently before the Austin City Council on fusion centers. Based on her experiences, does it sound to you like the fusion centers are operating within their defined role of information sharing? This is what the American Civil Liberties Union has to say about fusion centers. Who's spying in your neighborhood? Fusion centers collect and share information with local, state, and federal law enforcement, and increasingly with the military and the private sector. Although information sharing is legitimate and often necessary for law enforcement, the fusion centers are operating with little oversight at a time when new technology, government powers, and zeal in the war on terrorism are combining to threaten our privacy at an unprecedented level and turn America into a surveillance society. There are two fusion centers in Connecticut, and I'm going to give you the addresses of them and phone numbers, and I'm also going to share with you some questions to ask them that the American Civil Liberties Union has put out. In Connecticut, they're called the Connecticut Intelligence Center, and there's one in New Haven, which is a joint operation of the FBI and the Connecticut State Police, and it is at 600 State Street in New Haven, and their phone number is 203-503-5000. That's 203-503-5000. And the second one in Connecticut is in Hartford, and it's at 25 Sigourney Street on the sixth floor. So that's 25 Sigourney Street, and their phone number is 866-HLS-TIPS. So that's 866-HLS-TIPS. There's another phone number that appears to work for both of these in New Haven and Hartford, which is 203-777-6311. And here are some of the questions that the American Civil Liberties Union suggests you ask them. Is there a state, local, or regional fusion center in my area? Is the fusion center located within law enforcement facilities, in other government facilities, or private space? Who are the participants in the fusion center? Under what authority does the fusion center operate, state, local, or federal? Who's responsible for ensuring all federal, state, and local laws protecting privacy and civil liberties are enforced? What state or local sunshine laws or open meeting laws apply to activities taking place at fusion centers? What information, intelligence, and/or data are collected at the fusion center, and how is it stored? Who has access to this data at the fusion center? How is it protected from misuse? What does the fusion center do to ensure accuracy of the data it receives and disseminates? How is private, personally identifiable information received by the fusion center protected? Does the fusion center engage in data mining? What databases does the fusion center have access to, and how does it access them? Do any law enforcement entities participate in fusion center activities? If so, who? Do any private sector entities participate in the fusion center activities? If so, who? So, Little Connecticut has two fusion centers, and so far I haven't met anyone who even knows they exist. Please spread the word. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Attempts to delegitimize BDS, it's become more legitimate for New Zealanders as a political strategy to end, Israel's apartheid and occupation.
And I think we're reaching, you know, more of a consensus in this country about boycotts being a reasonable action to take in a context of Israeli impunity.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
I'm Sharif Sakoud, and you're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. On January 31st in Oakland, about 100 Bay Area activists and organizers gathered at the Oakland Federal Building to demonstrate in solidarity with Palestinian teenager Ahed Tamimi, who turned 17 in Israeli military detention the same day. Tamimi was detained in a night raid in the occupied West Bank village of Nabi Saleh 2 months ago, after video circulated showing her and a cousin slapping and shoving two heavily armed Israeli soldiers following an incident in which a soldier had shot in the head and seriously injured their 15-year-old cousin, Mohammed Tamimi. Outraged by a perceived insult to their occupation forces, Israeli leaders have vowed revenge against the Tamimi family and are subjecting Ahed, her mother Nariman, and cousin Noor to military trials in kangaroo courts with a near 100% conviction rate. Ahed Tamimi is one of some 300 Palestinian children currently in Israeli military detention. The demonstration was put together by the Palestine Action Network, and the following audio was recorded and compiled for the Electronic Intifada by Seja Shawashe of Arab Youth Organizing.
Viva, viva Palestina!
Viva, viva Palestina!
Viva, viva Palestina!
Viva, viva!
Is 17 years old today, and her whole entire life, she has only known life under occupation. She has only known what it's like to be brutalized by soldiers.
Free Palestine!
You know, I've actually been in jail on my birthday, and I can tell you that nobody should ever be in jail on their birthday. And we remember that not only Ahed and the other more than 300 children that are imprisoned by Israel, but thousands or probably tens of thousands of kids are in prison right here, and that is not okay. None of them should be in prison. We say no more cages.
No more cages.
And we say free all political prisoners.
Free all political prisoners.
The U.S. has the longest held political prisoners in the world, and it is our duty to get them out. So, free Ahed and all political prisoners.
Happy birthday!
Happy birthday!
For 17 years, you are continuing to resist, to live, to thrive, even when they try to imprison you. May we all learn that even when the walls are physically around us, let us never let them trap our minds or our spirit. Thank you, Ahed. And we will stand here. And let us not also forget how many folks are incarcerated in the county of Alameda? How many folks are incarcerated right here in Northern California and all of this state? Let us fight against incarceration from Pelican Bay to Palestine!
From Pelican Bay to Palestine!
From Pelican Bay to Palestine!
For the Electronic Intifada podcast, I'm Sharif Zakut.
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, and you're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. An Israeli lawfare group tied to the Mossad, Israel's deadly spy agency, said last month that it has filed a lawsuit against two New Zealand activists for, quote, influencing pop singer Lorde to cancel her Tel Aviv gig in late December. Lorde, who is also from New Zealand, had called her cancellation, quote, the right decision. Shirat Hadin, the group behind the lawsuit, is nominally suing on behalf of three Israeli teenagers who claim they are suffering, quote, emotional injury after learning that Lorde had canceled her concert. They are seeking thousands of dollars in damages against the activists. The lawsuit is being filed in Israel under a 2011 law that allows people to sue those who call for a boycott of Israel or its illegal settlements on occupied Palestinian land. The law is part of Israel's effort to stifle speech and activism in support of Palestinian rights. In December, activists Justine Sachs and Nadia Abu Shanab wrote an open letter to Lorde urging the singer to reconsider her planned performance in Tel Aviv. Since the targeted activists are in New Zealand and were exercising their free speech rights there, it is difficult to see how any Israeli judgment could be enforced. Meanwhile, a Florida lawmaker is attempting to have Lorde's upcoming concerts in that state canceled as punishment for her cancellation of the Tel Aviv show. In his demands, Republican State Representative Randy Fine is citing a Florida law that says no state or local government can conduct business exceeding $1 million with any organization engaged in a boycott of Israel. Florida is one of more than 20 states around the U.S. that has passed an anti-BDS measure, two of which are currently being challenged in courts in Kansas and Arizona due to their unconstitutionality. Joining us to talk about their activism and how they're analyzing the various acts of political theater around Lorde's cancellation of her Tel Aviv show are Justine Sachs and Nadia Abu Shanab. They join us from New Zealand. Welcome to the Electronic Intifada podcast, Nadia and Justine.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Hi.
So first off, have either of you received any summons or any formal legal notice that this alleged lawsuit against you is moving forward?
No, not as of yet, and unlikely to. We haven't heard anything, so we just sort of got caught up in the news cycle about them. I think it's now just kind of blown over.
So then let's break down what the motivations are. What's behind this Israeli lawfare group attacks against you? They know they can't actually enforce their agenda of censorship and legal repression. Because you're in a different country and you're protected by New Zealand's free speech laws, why would they even bother? What do you think is at the core of this kind of legal harassment?
So I've been thinking about this a little bit. I'm working on a piece that I'm writing at the moment, but I was thinking about kind of the mindset of Shadat Hadeen and also the trend that they represent, the idea of... obviously, they want a world. I think they genuinely want a world where criticism of Israel is criminalized. And in some cases, they're being successful with that. I think in cases where they're not being successful with that, or in spaces where they can't be, I mean, the US context is quite different from Aotearoa New Zealand, is that they'll settle for the headline, you know, that idea that might plant a seed in someone's head, that if you're going to do this stuff, it may come at a cost. I think that's probably where I'd put it at the moment, but there's probably a lot, you'd probably write a PhD on what they're up to in these kind of attempts, but I'd be interested in hearing what Justine thinks as well.
Yeah.
No, I mean, yeah, no. I think I've been really thinking alongside the same things as Nadia. I've been... you know, I'm obviously not scared for myself because I do feel kind of well protected here in New Zealand. And I, as Nadia said, I don't think it's the same climate as the United States. But watching what's been going on in the States, in Florida, mm-hmm. and these moves to kind of like legally consolidate these kind of repressive laws, you know, it's quite terrifying, really. And
it
is. I do think it represents a real threat to freedom of speech and to activists. Who are seeing like a kind of ramped up level of state violence and repression, to like clamp down on our activities and, you know, our ability to do kind of humanitarian social justice work.
And an escalation of tactics as well from like soft Zionist kind of tactics, which I actually think, you know, has backfired for them in this context. But Well, I think that's a real, you know, me and Justine can probably talk a little bit about this, but, you know, you had to be in New Zealand the day that this news dropped to understand the way that New Zealanders just responded to this with absolute disbelief. I think a lot of people, it was on major news and a huge TV show over here called The Project just did a piece that was like, this is ridiculous, you know, and completely supportive of ours. They brought on a lawyer who seemed to be a sort of like a liberal Zionist. And he just said, this is absolutely what this court case is attempting to do is absolutely outrageous. And regardless of whether we support boycotts or not, New Zealand and the New Zealand government need to absolutely throw their weight behind these two women, being me and myself and Justine. And you know, even the interviews of Shadat Hadeen that happened in New Zealand media, you could just hear even the journalists interviewing them were just thinking, what on earth? You know, this is such a contradiction to be talking about Israel as this democracy and then to be attempting this. And I think it really, for a lot of New Zealanders, drew attention to the huge contradictions at the heart of kind of Zionist thinking.
Yeah, I think really backfired spectacularly in New Zealand in particular. I think the United States, does seem to have a far more pro-Israel, like Zionist, like hardline Zionist stance. But even in Israel, even in New Zealand, among Israel's supporters, it was like just embarrassment almost.
We're speaking with Justine Sachs and Nadia Abushanab. They are two New Zealand activists who successfully encouraged pop singer Lorde to cancel her Tel Aviv show at the very end of last year. Nadia and Justine, let's talk a little bit about activism in New Zealand and some of the reactions that you've gotten just from regular folks who might have just been learning about this issue through this news story that came across, you know, local media and state media. you know, Lorde is just one of many artists and performers who have either canceled their gigs in Israel or have just chosen just to skip it altogether, something that's being called the silent boycott and is sending Israel's propagandists into a panic. Even by their own concessions in documents that the Electronic Intifada uncovered last year, the BDS movement, you know, is visibly growing and becoming more popular despite the well-financed efforts by Israel and the Israel lobby around the world to curb Palestine rights activism. What can you say about the boycott movement in New Zealand? And how active are people on the issue of Palestinian rights? What have you been hearing since, you know, since this happened last in December?
So I think there's been a groundswell of support for Palestinian human rights campaigns and also the BDS movement in New Zealand. I think it's becoming more and more popular, you know, as the days go by, and especially, I mean, I talked to Debbie Abbas, and she is one of the, like, an activist within the Palestinian Solidarity Network, and she's never seen so many young people, she's never seen so many people, period, involved, interested, coming to rallies, you know, getting in contact with them. And then, and like, within the Jewish community especially as well, we found, I mean, I'm a Jewish New Zealander. I went to the local Jewish school, brought up within the community. The sort of younger generations of Jewish people post Operation Protective Edge in 2014 have become incredibly politicized against, you know, Zionism. And there's this kind of like rejection, growing rejection of Zionism among us that's really like heartening to see. I mean, for me, I haven't, it's been a long time, but, you know, I'm sort of working within the community, with young Jews to kind of like educate them. And yeah, so that's what, Dayenu is like a solidarity project, essentially. It's just young, it's New Zealand Jews against the occupation. And so we work with the Palestinian Solidarity Network. And it's been, it has been like really heartening to see people kind of like break ranks with the established community who won't hear any criticism, who won't even have any kind of dialogue about Israel's like apartheid regime and the occupation, and to see these young Jews saying, you know what, no, I don't know who they're supposed to represent, but that's not me, and I want a space to at least talk about this. So things look good from where, well, no, things are looking brighter from where I'm standing in Auckland, but yeah, obviously I can't speak for the rest of the country or the world.
And Nadia, you know, what's your response, and how do you see the boycott movement expanding in New Zealand?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the Lorde thing is a huge deal. She's a massive person in New Zealand, and not just as an artist, but I think a bit of a cultural ambassador for where we're at. So, you know, upon kind of hearing that she was performing and writing our letter, and you know, we joined a lot of other people. A lot of mm-hmm. really great stuff came out of New Zealand. And that's one thing that I heard through the grapevine, that apparently Lorde, Ella, had said to some friends that what really surprised her was the level of reaction from people in New Zealand. So there was some great stuff written off the bat. Like, I woke up in the morning and I'd heard the news, and there was already some amazing tweets and a couple of blog posts that had gone up pretty much immediately from people in New Zealand that I didn't actually know, you know, because you sort of, you know, the solidarity community, it's quite large.
It's a small country.
There's some people in it, but, you know, New Zealand is a small country. You generally know people who are supportive of BDS. So I think what was really interesting is that for a few people who were fans of Lorde, who didn't actually know much about BDS, who had not been active in BDS activism in the past, when they heard about the fact that people were asking her to respect the boycott call and did some reading on it, they immediately understood what that meant, and they immediately thought it was the right thing to do. And I think we've been having a national conversation. So there was some of the major newspapers ran, I think, a poll saying, did Lorde make the right decision? And I think it was maybe, you know, 60% yes, 40% no. But that's huge. I don't think that would have been the same, you know, even 4 or 5 years ago. I think
Israel's occupation has really, really taken what we would call a hiding, which is like a beating, in New Zealand. And I think a lot of New Zealanders are now of the attitude that, you know, because we have that collective memory, we have that historical memory of the Springbok tour, and had that debate as a nation, is it okay, you know, is it okay to support things complicitly, as was done with South African apartheid, and the mobilization against apartheid and the boycott movement, you know, when it first started was not a popular thing, but then it came to a point where it made sense. And I think we're reaching, you know, more of a consensus in this country about boycotts being a reasonable action to take in a context of Israeli impunity.
Yeah, I agree. I think there was, I think like there's been a successive moments of politicization for New Zealand, for New Zealanders, which have kind of solidified this very justified negative view of the Israeli regime. And I think Lord was just sort of like, you know, the most recent and possibly the most influential one. But I've certainly watched among people who I think were undecided or perhaps thought it was too complicated, or they saw BDS as like extremely radical and like maybe like, you know, like there was a middle ground between BDS and like Zionism, kind of realized that BDS is a legitimate nonviolent strategy. And so in their attempts to delegitimize BDS, it's become more legitimate for a lot of New Zealanders as a political strategy to end, Israel's apartheid and occupation. So I think that's wonderful.
And just one quick thing. I mean, I know we've said a little bit on this, but I think it was really interesting. So after we wrote our letter, someone from the Jewish community, I didn't know who he was. He's a writer on a comedy show here.
Dan Gurriard.
Actually, his response letter was really interesting because it was really weak, you know, and that's from an objective perspective. I don't think there were many points made there. It seemed that New Zealand Zionists were really grasping at straws as to what they could actually say. There didn't seem to be anyone saying that Israel actually wasn't doing horrible things. It just seemed to be more of a deflection kind of strategy of, well, what about these other countries? Or, you know, we can't seriously end the occupation. It's there for security reasons and that kind of stuff. And I think...
Which isn't compelling to people.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just not compelling. It's not, it doesn't reach out to people. It doesn't convince them, quite rightly. Yeah.
I thought also what was really interesting was the kind of very effortless and unapologetic way that Lorde canceled her show and made that decision. For years, you know, people in the BDS movement have been, you know, going back and forth and trying to get their managers and tour managers to understand the severity of what it means to break an international picket line. There's been, you know, lots of debates between the artists and activists, and they go back and forth. And it felt like this was just such an easy decision that Lorde made, that it took the Zionists and Israel supporters by surprise. And what's also significant about that, and I know, Justine, you alluded to this, is that, you know, Lorde represents this younger generation of people all over the world who are looking at Israel's policies and deciding for themselves that that's not something that they particularly want to align with. Do you see this as kind of a turning point for the BDS movement, especially the cultural boycott component of BDS?
No, I absolutely do. I see it because I think that what you're seeing is a generational divide, and I think that's why the Zionist establishments are particularly worried, because younger people, you know, live in a politicized time, and they have a growing conscience, I think, about injustice locally and internationally that was maybe kind of lacking, and that terrifies them, because this idea that all struggles are linked. I mean, there's been articles about this, just like American Zionists freaking out.
The Jerusalem about Peace. Yeah. You say that?
About intersectionality. Yeah. Yes. They freak out about intersectionality. because they're like, oh God, if they realize all these struggles are linked, then they're going to be anti-Zionists. And it's like, this is exactly what we're seeing, because young people have this really, this burgeoning like conscience about this, about these issues. And I think it's inspiring. And I'm just, you know, it just fills you with that small sliver of hope that you kind of just have to hold on to in quite dark times. And I think, you know, and I think that, yeah, their hysterical response, and it was hysterical, the scrambling, it was mostly motivated because it was like this huge generation shift. And I saw these like young Lord fans suddenly like, I mean, and this speaks to why it's important to reach out to, you know, like pop stars and celebrities sometimes, because they do hold a position of influence. Suddenly they were interested and they wanted to learn, and they supported us. They supported our cause once they realized what it was about. And I thought, I was super encouraged by that.
And Nadia, do you want to chime in as well?
Yeah, I mean, totally. We are. And I think it's undeniable. And I think that's part of why... Yeah. You know, when we talk about what should Ahadine have done, it's actually reflective of that, because I think for people in Israel who are wondering how to combat BDS, they're very concerned right now. And that's why we're seeing an escalation of tactics. And we've been seeing this for years. I mean, this isn't new, because I've been involved with the movement now for about a decade. So we know it's been something that's been going on the whole time. But I think, you know, it was like you said, Nora, there was almost like a simplicity to this, almost like things had reached a particular moment. And I think the context of Trump and the US and the Jerusalem decision were actually, you know, they were the backdrop to this. And increasingly, you know, people like Lord had talked about, you know, because she's sort of part of, I guess, you know, she would probably describe herself as an intersectional feminist type person who's concerned about what's going on in the world. And she had said, you know, that we've got to stay informed and outraged about what's happening in the US and what's happening with Trump. And so, of course, the politics, like when you see Trump and Israel essentially against the world, and that, you know, this is something my dad's been talking to me a little bit about. He keeps saying, you know, you see that alignment so clearly. I think for a lot of people who are, you know, concerned about justice, concerned about questions of equality, it becomes a no-brainer to support the BDS movement, even in a context that is so hostile and where there has been such a smear campaign run against our movement, where individuals have had, you know, and experienced character assassinations whenever they speak out on this stuff. And that's not new. I mean, my dad was having his character assassinated when he was doing student activism in the UK in the 80s. So it's not a new tactic, but it's certainly one that they're extending. And I think that we just need to use this moment actually more than anything to keep going and keep doing stuff, and that's where we're at right now.
I mean, we talked about it before we wrote the letter. We were like, this is a moment that we, you know, we have to take advantage of to sort of raise awareness and to educate people, and like to not like speak out at this juncture would be such a missed opportunity. And I think we were quite right about that. Yeah.
Well, we look forward to seeing what else activists in New Zealand have up their sleeve in terms of engaging with and supporting the BDS movement. Justine Sachs and Nadia Abushanab, thank you so much for all of your work and for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for having us.
That's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. Thanks to Sharif Zakut, our music maker and production assistant. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada.
Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, support the Electronic Intifada by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
You know, we'd be walking up the main street out of drag, just being ourselves, boys and all that sort of stuff, and everybody and anybody were just calling out our names by our drag names, you know, no vagina, and the, you know,
our Lassie birth Dunham names man. Are non-existent now. Lacey, that's Nova. Ah, the pair of sluts.
There they are, the Dreamtime Divas.
Yeah.
But they've claimed us, you know.
And they're proud of us.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Another U.S. appeals court advances job bias protections, Bermuda delays marriage inequality and messy legal loopholes, and Australia's Indigenous Dreamtime Divas entertain for equality. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Sarah Sweeney.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending March 3rd, 2018. The Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled on February 26th that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which bans workplace bias based on a number of characteristics, including race and sex, extends to sexual orientation. The court ruled in 2000 and again in 2005 that sexual orientation was not covered under Title VII, but saying that legal doctrine evolves, Chief Judge Robert A. Katzman said in a media statement that we now conclude that sexual orientation discrimination is motivated, at least in part, by sex and is thus a subset of sex discrimination. That position has been supported by the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission since at least the days of the Obama administration, whose agencies also argued in favor of protections based not only on sexual orientation, but also gender identity. Saying that the EEOC was not speaking for the United States, a Justice Department spokesperson claimed that Title VII protects neither sexual orientation nor gender identity. Three members of the Manhattan-based court dissented from the 10-judge majority ruling. One argued that only Congress could create specific workplace bias protections for LGBT people.
The case involves the late Donald Zarda, a skydiving instructor for Long Island, New York's Altitude Express. He was fired in 2010 after trying to comfort a visibly anxious female customer by telling her as he was strapping her into the skydive suit not to worry about their close physical contact because he was 100% gay. Zarda died in a skydiving accident in 2014, but his friends and attorneys kept the appeal alive. Bill Moore, a co-executor of the late activist's estate, called the ruling a wonderful step forward for the country. I wish Don were here to see how he and his case have advanced the movement for LGBTQ equality. The decision only applies to the Second Circuit's jurisdiction, which covers the states of Connecticut, New York, and Vermont. All three states already outlaw workplace bias against LGBT people, but the appeals court decision is seen as significant because it's now the second such appeals court to rule for sexual orientation protections. A third federal appeals court has ruled to the contrary. Lower courts have also differed in their analyses, so the issue is almost certainly headed to the U.S. Supreme Court, sooner or later, for final resolution. Contrary to popular belief in the U.S., there are no federal laws specifically protecting LGBT people from any form of discrimination.
A married lesbian couple in Fort Worth, Texas, is suing Donald Trump's Department of Health and Human Services after a taxpayer-funded Roman Catholic adoptions agency refused to consider them to foster or adopt refugee children. They say that they were told that they were rejected because they did not mirror the Holy Family. Fatma Maruf and Bryn Esplin, both professors at Texas A&M University, told reporters that they were completely shocked by that explanation. Their lawsuit, filed by the queer advocacy group Lambda Legal, charges that the Health and Human Services Department is ultimately responsible for the obvious bias because the Conference of Catholic Bishops, which is also named in the suit, gets taxpayer money to operate their adoptions program through that federal agency. Maroof and Esplin have been married for almost 3 years. Maroof told the Texas Tribune that she and her wife believe that they are uniquely qualified to become foster parents of a refugee child. Maroof, a law professor, is the director of A&M's Immigrant Rights Clinic. Esplin is an assistant professor of bioethics. According to CNN, Catholic Charities had actually contacted Maroof to see if she'd speak about the work of her Immigration Rights Clinic at one of their upcoming events. "They are happy to take our skills," Esplin said, "but our home wasn't good enough."
The lawsuit was filed less than a week after the Republican-dominated Georgia State Senate passed its Keep Faith in Adoption and Foster Care Act, which specifically allows taxpayer-funded adoption and foster agencies to refuse to place children with gay or lesbian couples. Its fate in the state house is unclear, but a backlash has already begun. Speaking at a rally against the measure in Atlanta late this week, actor Daniel Newman, who stars in the popular Walking Dead TV series, which is filmed in Georgia, called the bill a total embarrassment to the state. Alyssa Milano, featured in the Netflix comedy Insatiable, that's currently shooting in Atlanta, told the trade publication Variety that if the bill becomes law, "I think the film and entertainment industry will pack up and leave the state of Georgia." Leading TV showrunner Ben Wexler, whose producing credits include Arrested Development, seems to be leading the charge. He rallied his peers in a tweet this week that said, "If this dumb bill becomes law, let's be done filming television shows in Georgia." Georgia lawmakers passed another bill late this week that withdraws certain state tax breaks to Atlanta-based Delta Airlines to punish it for cutting ties to the National Rifle Association after the Parkland school massacre.
Finland's parliament has approved a bill to make a change to the Maternity Act and recognize both women in a same-gender partnership as mothers from the moment their child is born. It applies after one of the women undergoes fertility treatment to become pregnant. Current law requires the non-biological parent to go through the slow and often expensive process of adopting the child in order to gain full parental rights. The bill, approved on February 28th by a vote of 122-42, was inspired by a citizens' initiative to change the law. It's expected to take effect in about a year. It's only the second such initiative to be approved by Parliament. The first opened civil marriage to same-gender couples in 2014.
The queer legal eagle who slew Doma is now taking on the alderman of Starkville, Mississippi. City lawmakers last week voted 4-3 to deny a special event permit for the city's first ever LGBT Pride Parade. Starkville Pride organizer Bailey McDaniel has recruited famed attorney and Mississippi native Roberta Kaplan to file suit against the city. Kaplan is best known as the lead attorney in the U.S. Supreme Court case that overturned key parts of DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, which had allowed the federal government to refuse to recognize the legal marriages of same-gender couples. That victory was a precursor to the High Court's ruling 2 years later that opened civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples across the country. Kaplan's motion for preliminary injunction of the Board of Aldermen's February 20th vote, filed in U.S. District Court on February 26th, calls for the application to be granted and for the city to provide in-kind services for a parade to be held on March 24th. A March 2nd story in the Starkville Daily News suggested that aldermen could be reconsidering their denial at a meeting in the coming week, so stay tuned.
Bermuda's government announced this week that, despite the specific ban on marriage equality for same-gender couples in the Domestic Partnership Act of 2017, same-gender couples will be allowed to legally marry on the North Atlantic island nation until May. According to the British Overseas Territories Royal Gazette newspaper, Home Affairs Minister Walton Brown said that the legislation passed in December would not take effect until June 1st to allow already planned weddings on the island and on Bermuda-registered ships to go forward. He said that the last day for lesbian and gay couples to get marriage licenses would be May 12th. In what may not be a coincidence, A legal challenge to the act is set to be heard in Bermuda's Supreme Court on May 21st and 22nd. It's being argued by former Attorney General Mark Pettingill, whose successful lawsuit at the same court in May 2017 led to that court's marriage equality ruling. With the Domestic Partnership Act of 2017, lawmakers made Bermuda the first nation on Earth to revoke marriage equality after it had already been declared legal.
And finally, veteran gay journalist Rex Walkner pointed out that Bermuda's Supreme Court is not the nation's highest court, but the government chose not to appeal its May 2017 marriage equality ruling. Pressured by the island's vocal evangelical leaders and their congregations, lawmakers reacted by passing the Domestic Partnership Act of 2017. Walkner also noted an odd wrinkle as things stand now. The original ruling that struck down the ban on marriage licenses for same-gender couples did only that. It did not extend specific marriage benefits to gay and lesbian couples. The Domestic Partnership Act of 2017, on the other hand, both re-banned marriage equality and extended all the benefits of marriage to newly created domestic partners. So if the ban is overturned in the Supreme Court, same-gender couples would continue to be able to marry, but their marriages still wouldn't have any benefits, other than two achieved in earlier battles, adoption and immigration. But a same-gender couple could enter into a domestic partnership and get all the benefits of marriage. It would be up to Parliament to fix the messy inequities.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending March 3rd, 2018. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Sarah Sweeney.
And I'm John Dyer V.
Extra, read all about it. Extra!
Have you checked our website lately? For now playing information and behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show, log on to thiswayout.org.
I decided long ago never to walk in anyone's shadows. If I fail, if I succeed,
Priscilla Queen of the Desert made Sydney's infamous drag scene, well, famous. But a whole new generation is emerging in the ever-growing world of Indigenous drag queens in Australia. Dreamtime Divas is one of those rising acts. But this down-under duo is more than just glitz and glamour, as This Way Out's Barry McKay discovered when he caught up with them after a Mardi Gras performance.
Here I am with the Dreamtime Divas. We've just performed at Bumalli Aboriginal Art Gallery in Leichhardt in Sydney. Thank you very much to both of you. First of all, I'd like you to get you to introduce yourselves.
Hi, everybody. I'm Lacey Dunhamet. And
I'm Nova Jaina.
Beautiful. Can you tell me a little bit about Lacey Dunhamet? Because people overseas may not know what the reference there is.
I'm a bit of an ode to a local sister who's a bit of a singer-songwriter celebrity here back at home, and her name's Casey Donovan. And, you know, I just had a little bit of a cheat. She's my inspiration, and I've come up with Lacey Dunhamet, or two, or three, you know. Yeah.
So could you tell me a bit about your backgrounds? What was it like growing up gay and Indigenous?
Very difficult. Difficult in the sense of having expectations from, you know, particularly my mum, wanting more grandchildren, even though she had like 26, 27 of them, knowing very well that I was a gay boy back then when I came out to her when I was a 13, 14-year-old boy. You know, not being accepted by my peers as such, you know, being asked to play a game of football or do all the blokey, manly boy things. So, you know, I kind of dealt with that at a very late stage in life. Didn't really come to terms and comfortable with myself till I was about 35. I'm now a 42-year-old man, you know, drag queen. But, yeah, I have coped with all the ups and downs of... Oh, just the ignorance of people.
It was a little bit different for me. It wasn't only the Aboriginal side of it. It was also my family was very religious. That whole, you know, stereotypical thing that homosexuals are pedophiles and predators and all that kind of stuff. So that was really hard. That was serious. And burly brothers and things like that. So, you know, went through a lot. But come out the other side, fierce and fabulous.
What is the Dreamtime Divas story?
It really started as a bit of fun. For a local gig that we were asked to do, and we were dabbling in drag, and they thought, oh, you know, let's frock up and have a bit of fun. It was the International Women's Week, so we put on a cabaret show, and it went crazy, you know. We sold out 300 tickets, and
where
just
was that?
That was in Kempsey at our
just
local RSL.
Small town.
Yes,
small country town, population of about maybe 26,000 people.
Yeah.
Like family and friends and, you know, wider community, just... Yeah. The whole community supported us.
And then everywhere we went after that, it was like, oh, that was fabulous. When's your next show? When's your next show? So it was kind of, okay, let's put on another show. You know, let's have fun. And it developed from there. We created the Dreamtime Divas. And you know, and then we started to get recognition and a little bit of a platform. And so we wanted to bring our past into it and try and create change and bring on some of the importance of, you know, youth suicide, teen, you know, depression and all that that comes along with homophobia, and especially in rural communities in Australia.
Particularly amongst LGBTQI kids, you know, who are finding it difficult to come to terms with themselves and
who,
you know,
they are.
In who they are and just the acceptance and all that, what, you know, we all need.
So I understand in your hometown of where you were living at the time, Kempsey, you were somewhat of local celebrities.
Yes. You know, we'd be walking up the main street out of drag, you know, boy, you know, just being ourselves, boys and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, everybody and anybody would just calling out our names by our drag names, you know, Nova, Gina, and, you know, Lassie.
Our birth names
man.
Are non-existent now.
Yeah,
that's Lacey, that's Nova. Ah, a pair of sluts, you know,
there they are, the Dreamtime Divas.
Yeah.
But they've claimed us, they own us, you know.
And they're proud of us.
There's a sense of pride with that claim of ownership, and that's a great feeling.
And we want to take that and do something positive with it. We don't want to let them down either, because without them we wouldn't be here today.
So. That's exactly right. Absolutely, yes.
Tell us about your fabulous costumes and makeup, and who inspires you both?
For me, my sister girl, Casey Donovan, inspires me. She's my inspiration for my character and my looks and things, you know. And my costumes, it's a bit of a buy something and grab a needle and cotton and add some sequins and hoping it looks good. Yeah, we don't spend a lot of money. We can't, but whatever goes, and we team with the theme. Yeah.
Nova, I love your makeup above your eyes. Where did that come from?
My inspiration is divine, first and foremost, my queen. And I think, you know, there's a bit of Grace Jones there as well, because she's considered quite eccentric. But then I have American queens with the likes of Nina Flowers. Yeah. She's fabulous. Yeah. But then there are also a few other Indigenous queens here in Australia, the likes of Destiny Has Arrived and Miscellaneous and JoJo's Ho and Crystal
Josie
Love,
Baker.
Baker, you know, Shaniqua, you know, all my drag sisters.
What songs do you like to perform to?
All kinds of songs, from country to ballads, pop.
I'm a bit of a ballad queen. I give good mouth.
Yeah, she's fantastic. Whitney and Beyonce are quite my shtick, I'd like to think. You know, I feel their songs, and I feel like if I portray, you know, with emotion, the songs themselves.
I love big power ballad, you know, so like Jennifer Hudson and the big voices, you know, that kind of stuff. Christina Aguilera, her vocal ability, and to be able to match that with lip syncing, you know, that's where I'm at.
Yes, I do. And I love where I'm going.
I'm Lacey Dunaman.
And I'm Nova Gina. And we are the Dreamtime Divas.
And you're listening to
This Way Out.
This is Barry Mackay in Sydney, Australia,
with the Dreamtime Divas. You were doing support work with LGBT Indigenous youth in the Kempsey area. Can you tell us a bit about the Dreamtime Divas mission statement, if you like?
More or less, we want to raise awareness for youth depression and teen suicide. You know, for homophobia to affect our young people so much that they're taking their own lives, that's something we've got to help with. You know, we have a platform, let's do something with it, and that's what we're about.
As well as raising the awareness of our LGBTQI kids, you know, committing suicide. You know, such a rate that it's just ridiculous.
It's huge. The statistics in Australia are overwhelming.
Children who are going through mental health issues, you know, they just need to be recognised and hopefully addressed.
And our main audience, what we've found, and that's the difference between us and a lot of the other queens, is our main audience is mainstream community. You know, we don't have gay paths where we're from or gay clubs and things like that. So our audience is mainstream community, heterosexual, married couples, elders, everything. So without that direct message, it's more of being us, being fabulous, these people loving us and accepting us for us, and these younger generations seeing us be accepted and make them feel, oh, it's okay. You know, if they can frock up and go to that extreme, it's not so hard to just come out.
And Nova, you had an example in your own family of someone who took their own life.
About a year ago now, it was his anniversary, my 19-year-old nephew at the time, he'd committed suicide, and so his name was Baylon Hoskins, and his parents approached us, the Dreamtime Divas, and asking for this year's Mardi Gras, you know, 2018 Mardi Gras, if we could lead a Baylon's gift.
They've created a foundation in his honour, and they're rolling out programs across all our local schools, primary schools, and targeting these issues. Hey, you know, sexual diversity, gender diversity, and all that.
So they've tapped into Headspace and Beyond Blue, so they're quite renowned Australian, I don't know, probably international organisations where they're dealing with mental health issues and, you know, concerns that concern our kids, basically. But there are quite a few gifts around Australia. The parents of the children, they've created gifts as well, so there's quite a few that
together.
They're all collaborated. And so, you know, with pride, we've been asked this year to lead Baylon's Gifts, which is what we're all about. And you know, if we can hopefully help get that message out, as Lacey mentioned, if it takes us getting dressed up in a frock, you know, 4.5 fucking hours to do it, then so be it, you know, because we have fun and we have quite a following here in Australia. We, you know, it's really quite an experience.
Nova, you took part in the recent Miss First Nations contest in Darwin. What is the contest and how did it go?
The Miss First Nations contest was our first ever all Indigenous drag queen competition. So there were six of us. It was quite similar to RuPaul's Drag Race, where we were asked to go through and do particular looks and photo shoots. You know, a couple of the queens got into cages with crocodiles, you know, with just this perspex and boxes in front of them. Like, no, you're the crazy girls, you can have that, you can win that. All for it. But it was just all about showcasing our, you know, unique, I think, Indigenous drag queen personas and just putting ourselves out there, because whether a lot of you guys know, if you walk into any particular gay bar in any Australian cities, there's not a great many representatives of Aboriginal Indigenous drag queens here in Australia. So, you know, hoping that this can...
It was a huge platform for all our sisters. You know, we started a few years ago and there was one sister that we knew, and now there's plenty, you know, and we're all in together and we have a huge sisterhood and we've got each other's back and,
for it. Nova, you also appeared in the film Black Divas. Can you tell us a bit about that?
The Black Divas film is a production from Kalori Productions and Persky Productions as well. During the week leading up to the Miss First Nations competition in Darwin last year, back in September, I believe it was. They followed all of us contestants with our private lives. So, you know, it was us in our home lives, our day jobs, and all that sort of stuff. And so, yeah, all six of us were followed around.
And then home documented life, the whole.
And
the
then
whole
documented the whole Miss First Nations for the week long that it was happening, and then probably a week after the, you know, sort of see how things, how we were feeling after it all.
And that's going to be shown in the States now, I hear.
It's creating a lot of momentum at the moment. Mm. I'm pretty sure it's been the number one film within the Sydney Queer Film Festival for the 40th anniversary of the Mardi Gras. We're doing our first red carpet next week.
Yes.
So
media slut.
Yes.
Media slut.
Big slut.
Yes. You're such talented performers. How difficult is it to break into the mainstream drag performing scene in Australia?
I don't know how difficult it is with mainstream. It's not really something that's on our agenda.
Why aren't you performing on Oxford Street? Why aren't you performing in Melbourne?
Yeah.
Location's
a big thing. We don't live in the city. So I have performed on Oxford Street within the Drag Nation competition that they have in every year, and that's national. But, yeah, I think it's more, you know, we're not that club city queen that's there to perform to be fabulous. We've got a message, we've got a passion, we've got a drive, so it's everywhere else we want to be.
Being here in Sydney now, you know, we've had, you know, our flights, return flights and accommodations and our fees and all that sort of and blah, blah, blah. But if we were to have travelled to where we live, back up in the country, we've just recently moved from Kempsey, a population of about 26,000, as I've mentioned before, to an even smaller community called Corakai in New South Wales, mm-hmm. on the East Coast, which is like, what, 700 or 800 people? I don't know. I never really took any
It's
notice.
Events like this, you know, Corigrah this week, leading into Mardi Gras, and that's when we do get our city gigs. You know, we're here tonight, and we're also performing at the famous Imperial Hotel in Erskineville on Mardi Gras
that's
Parade
where
night.
So Priscilla
where
Queen,
they shot Priscilla. So we're honoured to be performing there at such an iconic venue. So yes.
That's
great.
That's very exciting. Yeah.
And lastly, what is the future now for the Dreamtime Divas?
Well, I think with this Black Divas film and the
viral.
Well, yeah, but we're going to be poxed up, so we're going to need, you know, STD pills and tablets and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. But this
penicillin
is
lump.
Penicillin. Well, you know, we'll take what we can. But we believe that this is going to go international with film festivals throughout the world, so I've been told.
And we wanted to open no doors for those young queens in the next generation under us, Aboriginal queens who only ever see white queens on stage or in cinema or on theatre, you know.
Yeah.
The doors are open now, sisters. Go for it. Go hard or go home.
Nova and Lacey, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you,
Thank you, Barry. Our pleasure, darling.
Call me.
With the Dreamtime Divas,
this is Barry Mackay in Sydney, Australia, for This Way Out.
You can see Barry's Dreamtime Divas interview with some performance video clips at thiswayout.org. Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Program material this week came from John Dyer V and Sarah Sweeney, with thanks to Steve Pride and from Barry Mackay. Whitney Houston performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Woolson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors, who make this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 3ECB Croydon, Victoria, Experiment FM Ames, Iowa, KUOI Moscow, Idaho, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station, where our big birthday bash is coming soon. So stay tuned, y'all. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on listener-sponsored KPFA and kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. What does Noam Chomsky do in the film Manufacturing Consent? Perhaps the easier question to ask is, what doesn't Chomsky do? Because the range of issues he addresses and the critiques he presents and the analyses he offers are a tour de force of social and political commentary and principled dissent. Yesterday, we presented audio excerpts of this award-winning documentary film that does a deep dive into the ideas and insights of a scholar and activist who's been called a global phenomenon. Today, we have for you an entirely new and different set of excerpts about the mainstream media and governmental power, about U.S. foreign policy and intellectual self-defense, about Chomsky's sense of what a better form of social and political organization, better than the current system, would be. We are delighted to be able to offer, again, Manufacturing Consent, an almost three-hour-long film on DVD for a pledge of $120 to listener-supported KPFA. And this is the last day of this fund drive that Sasha and I will be asking you to support specifically Against the Grain in our regular time slot. So we hope and we need to hear from you this hour. Again, for a pledge of $120 or more to KPFA, you get this sprawling, amazing, award-winning film called Manufacturing Consent. For, again, that's a pledge of $120. And you can break that down into six monthly installments of $20 each. So the phone numbers are 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, easily remembered as 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can also pledge securely online at kpfa.org. Now, although Manufacturing Consent came out in 1992, it's both striking and disturbing how relevant its message is to our current situation, our situation today. We begin our audio tour of this film with a kind of case study, a comparison that Noam Chomsky made between U.S. media coverage of what the Khmer Rouge did in and to Cambodia and what Indonesia did in and to a small country called East Timor. In this part of the film, Chomsky responds to a question about how he thinks the U.S. mainstream media operates.
One obvious way is to try to find more or less paired examples. History doesn't offer true controlled experiments, but it often comes pretty close. So one can find atrocities or abuses of one sort that on the one hand are committed by official enemies and on the other hand are committed by friends and allies or by the favored state itself, by the United States in the U.S. case. And the question is whether the media accept the government framework or whether they use the same agenda, the same set of questions, the same criteria for dealing with the two cases as any honest outside observer would do.
If you think America's involvement in the war in Southeast Asia is over, think again.
The Khmer Rouge are the most genocidal people on the face of the earth.
Peter Jennings reporting from the killing fields, Thursday.
I mean, the great act of genocide in the modern period is Pol Pot, 1975 to through 1978, that atrocity. I think it would be hard to find any example of a comparable outrage and outpouring of fury and so on and so forth. So that's one atrocity. Well, it just happens that in that case, history did set up a controlled experiment.
Have you ever heard of a place called East Timor?
Can't say that I have.
Where?
East Timor?
Nope.
No,
Well, it happens that right at that time there was another atrocity, very similar in character, but differing in one respect. We were responsible for it, not Pol Pot.
Hello, I'm Louise Penny, and this is Radio Noon. If you've been listening to the program fairly regularly over the last few months, you'll know East Timor has come into the conversation more than once, particularly when we were talking about foreign aid and also the war and a new world order. People wondered why, if the UN was serious about a new world order, no one was doing anything to help East Timor. The area was invaded by Indonesia in 1975. There are reports of atrocities against the Timorese people. And yet Canada and other nations have consistently voted against UN resolutions to end the occupation. Today, we're going to take a closer look at East Timor, what's happened to it, and why the international community is doing nothing to help. One of the people who have been most active is Elaine Bruyere, a photojournalist from British Columbia. She's the founder of the East Timor Alert Network, and she joins me in studio now. Hello.
Hi.
One tragedy compounding a tragedy is that a lot of people don't know much about East Timor. Where is it?
East Timor is just north of Australia, about 420 kilometers, and it's right between the Indian and Pacific Oceans. Just south of East Timor is a deep water sea lane, perfect for U.S. submarines to pass through. There's also huge oil reserves there. One of the unique things about East Timor is that it's truly one of the last surviving ancient civilizations in that part of the world. The Timorese spoke 30 different languages and dialects amongst a group of 700,000 people. Today, less than 5% of the world's people live like the East Timorese, basically self-reliant. They live really outside of the global economic system. Small societies like the East Timorese are much more democratic and much more egalitarian, and there's much more sharing of power and wealth. Before the Indonesians invaded, most people lived in small rural villages. The old people in the village were like the university. They passed on tribal wisdom from generation to generation. Children grew up in a safe, stimulating, nurturing environment. A year after I left East Timor, I was appalled when I heard that Indonesia had invaded. They didn't want a small independent country setting an example for the region.
East Timor was a Portuguese colony. Indonesia had no claim to it and in fact stated that they had no claim to it. During the period of colonization, there was a good deal of politicization that different groups developed. A civil war broke out in August 75. It ended up in a victory for Fretilin, which was one of the groupings, described as populist Catholic in character with some typical leftish rhetoric.
Indonesia at once started intervening.
What's the situation? When did those ships come in?
They start arriving since Monday. 6-7 boats together, very close to our border. No, they're not there just for fun, you know. They're preparing a massive operation.
Something happened here last night that moved us very deeply. It was so far outside our experience as Australians that we'll find it very difficult to convey to you, but we'll try. Sitting on woven mats under a thatched roof in a hut with no walls, we were the target of a barrage of questioning from men who know they may die tomorrow and cannot understand why the rest of the world does not care.
Ford and Kissinger visited Jakarta, I think it was December 5th. We know that they had requested that Indonesia delay the invasion until after they left because it would be too embarrassing. And within hours, I think, after they left, the invasion took place on December 7th.
What happened on December 7th in 1975 is just one of the great, great evil deeds of history. Early in the morning, bombs began dropping on Dili. The number of troops that invaded Dili that day almost outnumbered the entire population of the town. And for 2 or 3 weeks, there was just, they just killed people.
This council must consider Indonesian aggression against East Timor as the main issue of the discussion.
When the Indonesians invaded, the UN reacted as it always does, calling for sanctions and condemnation and so on. Various watered-down resolutions were passed, but the U.S. was very clearly not going to allow anything to work.
So the Timorese were fleeing into the jungles by the thousands. By late 1977-78, Indonesia set up receiving centers for those Timorese who came out of the jungle waving white flags. Those the Indonesians thought were more educated or who were suspected of belonging to Fretilin or other opposition parties were immediately killed. They took women aside and flew them off to Dili in helicopters for use by the Indonesian soldiers. They killed children and babies. But in those days, their main strategy and their main weapon was starvation.
By 1978, it was approaching really genocidal levels. The church and other sources estimated about 200,000 people killed. The U.S. backed it all the way. The U.S. provided 90% of the arms. Right after the invasion, arms shipments were stepped up. When the Indonesians actually began to run out of arms in 1978, the Carter administration moved in and increased arms sales. And other Western countries did the same. Canada, England, Holland, and everybody who could make a buck was in there trying to make sure they could kill more Timorese. There is no Western concern for issues of aggression, atrocities, human rights abuses, and so on, if there's a profit to be made from them. Nothing could show it more clearly than this case. It wasn't that nobody had ever heard of East Timor. Crucial to remember that there was plenty of coverage in the New York Times and elsewhere before the invasion. The reason was that there was concern at the time over the breakup of the Portuguese Empire and what that would mean. There was a fear that it would lead to independence or Russian influence or whatever. After the Indonesians invaded, the coverage dropped. There was some, but it was strictly from the point of view of the State Department and Indonesian generals, never a Timorese refugee. As the atrocities reached their maximum peak in 1978, when it really was becoming genocidal, coverage dropped to zero in the United States and Canada, the two countries I've looked at closely, literally dropped to zero. All this was going on at exactly the same time as the great protest of outrage over Cambodia. The level of atrocities was comparable. In relative terms, it was probably considerably higher in Timor. It turns out right in Cambodia in the preceding years, 1970 through 1975, there was also a comparable atrocity for which we were responsible. The major U.S. attack against Cambodia started with the bombings of the early 1970s. They reached a peak in 1973, and they continued up till 1975. They were directed against inner Cambodia. Very little is known about them because the media wanted it to be secret. They knew it was going on, they just didn't want to know what was happening. The CIA estimates about 600,000 killed during that five-year period, which is mostly either U.S. bombing or a U.S.-sponsored war. So that's pretty significant killing. But also, the conditions in which it left Cambodia were such that high U.S. officials predicted that about 1 million people would die in the aftermath just from hunger and disease because of the wreckage of the country. Pretty good evidence from U.S. government sources and scholarly sources that the intense bombardment was a significant force, maybe a critical force, in building up peasant support for the Khmer Rouge, who before that were a pretty marginal element. Well, that's just the wrong story. After 1975, atrocities continued, and that became the right story, because now they're being carried out by the bad guys. Well, it was bad enough. In fact, current estimates are that, well, you know, they vary. I mean, the CIA claim 50 to 100,000 people killed and maybe another million or so who died one way or another. Michael Vickery is the one person who's given a really close, detailed analysis. His figure is maybe 750,000 deaths above the normal. Others, like Ben Kiernan, suggest higher figures, but so far without a detailed analysis. Anyway, it was terrible, no doubt about it. Although the atrocities, the real atrocities, were bad enough, they weren't quite good enough for the purposes needed. Within a few weeks after the Khmer Rouge takeover, the New York Times was already accusing them of genocide. At that point, maybe a couple hundred or maybe a few thousand people had been killed. And from then on, it was a drumbeat, a chorus of genocide. Bestseller on Cambodia, Pol Pot, is called Murder in a Gentle Land. Up until April 17, 1975, was a gentle land of peaceful, smiling people, and after that, some horrible Holocaust took place. Very quickly, a figure of 2 million killed was hit upon. In fact, what was claimed was that the Khmer Rouge boast of having murdered 2 million people. Facts are very dramatic. In the case of atrocities committed by the official enemy, extraordinary show of outrage, exaggeration, no evidence required, faked photographs are fine, anything goes. Also, vast amount of lying. I mean, an amount of lying that would have made Stalin cringe. It was fraudulent. And we know that it was fraudulent by looking at the response to comparable atrocities for which the United States was responsible. Early 70s Cambodia, Timor are two very closely paired examples.
That is Noam Chomsky, and you are listening to audio excerpts of a film that won 22 awards. 22 awards. It's called Manufacturing Consent, and I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on listener-supported KPFA, and this is the last time that Sasha and I will come to you during our regularly scheduled time slot to ask you to support KPFA and to support Against the Grain and send a message to the powers that be here that Against the Grain is something that people care about and want to support. For a $120 or greater pledge to KPFA, you get this film on DVD. It's called Manufacturing Consent, and it is amazing. And we are playing portions of it for you today, but as you can imagine, you're not getting the visuals, and you're not getting the vast majority of the 2 hour and 47 minute documentary film from which these audio excerpts are taken. It's called Manufacturing Consent. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. If you call that number, a friendly phone volunteer will answer the phone and you will be able to tell them what you'd like to donate to KPFA and if you want to get something really kind of amazing and iconic in return. This is a classic film, an iconic film. And as I said, it is still ultra relevant today, which is both amazing and quite disturbing. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can also donate online at kpfa.org. And we have a wonderful combo pack for those of you who have a little bit more money in your pocket, maybe from a tax refund you've gotten recently. And that is both the film, Manufacturing Consent, all 2 hours and 47 minutes of it, and the film, No Gods, No Masters, A History of Anarchism in Three Parts. And that's on two DVDs. And the people here have allowed us to discount that pledge rate. It would normally be a $300 pledge to get both of those thank you gifts. You get both for a $250 one-year pledge to KPFA, which you can also break down into six equal monthly installments. And no, you don't have to pay all your installments before you get this combo pack or before you get this film, Manufacturing Consent, coming your way. Why do we pair No Gods, No Masters, which has been featured many times on these airwaves, this fund drive, including on Against the Grain, with Manufacturing Consent? Because Noam Chomsky has identified himself repeatedly as an anarchist. And if we have time, we're going to play some of why or what he believes about a better system, what a better system would look like and what a better system could look like in the United States in contrast to what is actually the current system. But that is why we are pairing this Manufacturing Consent with No Gods, No Masters, which is an incredible film in and of itself, a sprawling film on two DVDs. You can get both Manufacturing Consent and No Gods, No Masters for a $250 pledge to KPFA. Noam Chomsky, of course, professor of linguistics emeritus at MIT for a long time, institute professor there, joined the University of Arizona faculty last fall, widely regarded as one of the world's foremost critics of U.S. foreign policy, has published numerous groundbreaking and best-selling books, articles, essays on global politics, history, and linguistics, one of the most widely quoted intellectuals living today. You can't go wrong with Noam Chomsky, and this film beautifully presents his ideas and his stances and the many forms or fora in which he has appeared. It's basically like, you know, if you could get the highlights of dozens of his appearances, his presentations, his speeches, his seminar, and if you could get the highlights, the best parts of all of those, that, and he's done, of course, presentations worldwide, and you put them all into to one film, you get them all. I'm not being very articulate here, but you get them all in one film. You get highlights from all these presentations in this one film called Manufacturing Consent. He is a global phenomenon. He is scathing. He is brilliant. He is committed. And he presents a counter-narrative unlike anybody else. And KPFA and Pacifica Radio have been very pleased to present his voice over the years. Manufacturing Consent is a... I think it's a collector's item. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Let's return now to more of the audio excerpts we've prepared for you today. Fresh excerpts from this film, Manufacturing Consent.
When Chomsky came around, he had with him a file of all the coverage in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and other papers of East Timor. And he would go to the meticulous degree that if, for example, the London Times had a piece on East Timor, and then it appeared in the New York Times, that if a paragraph was cut out, he'd compare and he'd say, look, this key paragraph, right near the end, which is really what tells the whole story, was left out of the New York Times version of the London Times thing.
There was a story in the London Times, which is pretty accurate. The New York Times revised it radically. Didn't just leave a paragraph out. They revised it and gave it a totally different cast. And it's not a matter of happening one time, two times, five times, 100 times. It happened all the time.
when they did give coverage, it was from the point of view of, it was a whitewash of the United States. Now, you know, that's not an error. That's systematic, consistent behavior, in this case, without even any exception. I mean, this is way beyond just demonstrating the subservience of the media to power. I mean, they are actual, they have real complicity in genocide in this case. The reason that the atrocities can go on is because nobody knows about them. If anyone knew about them, there'd be protests and pressure to stop them. So therefore, by suppressing the facts, the media are making a major contribution to some of the, probably the worst act of genocide since the Holocaust.
You say that what the media do is to ignore certain kinds of atrocities that are committed by us and our friends, and to play up enormously atrocities that are committed by them and our enemies. Because your method is not only to ignore the corpses created by them, but also to ignore corpses that are created by neither side, but which are irrelevant to your ideological
That's
agenda.
Totally untrue.
Well, let me give you an example. Okay. One of your own causes that you take very seriously is the cause of the Palestinians, and a Palestinian corpse weighs very heavily on your conscience, and yet a Kurdish corpse does not.
That's not true at all. I've been involved in Kurdish support groups for years. That's absolutely true. That's absolutely false. I mean, just ask the people who are involved in. I mean, you know, they come to me. I sign their petitions and so on and so forth. If you look at the things we've written, I mean, let's take a look. I mean, I'm not Amnesty International. I can't do everything. I'm a single person. But if you read, say, take a look, say, at the book that Edward Herman and I wrote on this topic. In it, we discuss three kinds of atrocities. What we called benign bloodbaths, which nobody cares about, constructive bloodbaths, which are the ones we like, and nefarious bloodbaths, which are the ones that the bad guys do. The principle that I think we ought to follow is not the one that you stated. You know, it's a very simple ethical point. You're responsible for the predictable consequences of your actions. You're not responsible for the predictable consequences of somebody else's actions. The most important thing for me and for you is to think about the consequences of your actions. What can you affect?
These are the things to keep in mind. These are not just academic exercises. We're not analyzing the media on Mars or in the 18th century or something like that. We're dealing with real human beings who are suffering and dying and being tortured and starving because of policies that we are involved in. We, as citizens of democratic societies, are directly involved in and are responsible for. And what the media are doing is ensuring that we do not act on our responsibilities, and that the interests of power are served, not the needs of the suffering people, and not even the needs of the American people, who would be horrified if they realized the blood that's dripping from their hands because of the way they're allowing themselves to be deluded and manipulated by the system.
Before the break, you were mentioning the media putting forth the information that the power elite want. I'm not sure if I understand, how does the power elite do this, and why do we stand for it? Why does it work so well?
Okay, well, I think here we have to, I mean, there are really two questions here. One, is this picture of the media true? And there you have to look at the evidence. I mean, I've given one example, and that shouldn't convince anybody. One has to look at a lot of evidence to see whether this is true. I think anyone who investigates it will find out that the evidence to support it is simply overwhelming. In fact, it's probably one of the best supported conclusions in the social sciences. But the other question is, how does it work?
Those who believe in democracy and freedom have a serious task ahead of them. What they should be doing, in my view, is dedicating their efforts to helping the despised common people to struggle for their rights and to realize the democratic goals that constantly surface throughout history. They should be serving not power and privilege, but rather their victims. Freedom and democracy are by now not merely values to be treasured, they are quite possibly the prerequisite to survival.
Is it possible for the lights to get a little brighter and see somebody out there?
Yeah, for the last hour and 41 minutes, I've been whining about
how the elite and how the government have been using thought control to keep radicals like yourself out of the public limelight. Now, you're here. I don't see any CIA men waiting to drag you off. You were in the paper. That's where everyone here heard you were coming from, in the paper, and I'm sure they're going to publish your comments in the paper. Now, a lot of countries, you would have been shot for what you have done today. So what are you whining about? We are allowing you to speak, and I don't see any thought control.
First of all, I hadn't said one word about my being kept out of the limelight. The way it works here is quite different. Now, I don't think you heard what I was saying, but the way it works here is that there is a system of shaping, control, and so on, which gives a certain perception of the world. I gave one example. I'll give you sources where you can find thousands of others. And it has nothing to do with me. It has to do with marginalizing the public and ensuring that they don't get in the way of elites who are supposed to run things without interference. Let me tell you a personal experience. I happened to be in Madison, Wisconsin, on a listener-supported radio station, community radio station, a very good one. I was having an interview with the news director. I've been on that program dozens of times, usually by telephone. And he's very good. He gets to all sorts of people. And he started the interview by playing for me a tape of an interview that he had just had and had broadcast with the guy who's some mucky-muck in Nightline. I think his name is Jeff Greenfield or some such name. Does that name mean anything?
I'm Jeff Greenfield for Nightline in New York.
What about just in a selection of guests to analyze things? Why is Noam Chomsky never on Nightline?
I couldn't begin to tell you.
He's one of the leading intellectuals in the entire world.
I have no idea. I mean, I can make some guesses. He may be one of the leading intellectuals who can't talk on television. You know, that's a standard that's very important to us. If you got a 22-minute show and a guy takes 5 minutes to warm up, now I don't know whether Chomsky does or not, he's out. One of the reasons why Nightline has the usual suspects is one of the things you have to do when you book a show is know that the person can make the point within the framework of television. And if people don't like that, they should understand it is about as sensible to book somebody who will take 8 minutes to give an answer as it is to book somebody who doesn't speak English. But in the normal given flow, that's another culture-bound thing. We got to have English-speaking people. We also need concision.
So Greenfield, or whatever his name is, hit the nail on the head. The U.S. media are alone in that it is, you must meet the condition of concision. You got to say things between two commercials or in 600 words. And that's a very important fact, because the beauty of concision, you know, saying a couple of sentences between two commercials, the beauty of that is that you can only repeat conventional thoughts.
I was reading Chomsky 20 years ago. I think his notion, didn't he co-author a new book called Engineering Consent or The Manufacturing of Consent? Mm-hmm. I mean, some of that stuff to me looks like it's from Neptune.
This is the first time the Neptune system has been seen clearly by human eyes. These pictures, taken only hours ago by Voyager 2, are its latest contribution.
You know, he's perfectly entitled to say that I'm seeing it through a prism, too. But my view of that, of his notions about the limits of debate in this country, is absolutely wacko.
Suppose I get up on Nightline, say, and I'm given whatever it is, 2 minutes, and I say Gaddafi is a terrorist, Khamenei is a murderer, you know, et cetera, et cetera. The Russians, you know, invaded Afghanistan, all this sort of stuff. I don't need any evidence. Everybody just nods. On the other hand, suppose you say something that just isn't regurgitating conventional pieties. Suppose you say something that's the least bit unexpected or controversial. Suppose you say,
I mean, the biggest international terror operations that are known are the ones that are run out of Washington.
Or suppose you say, what happened in the 1980s is the U.S. government was driven underground.
Suppose I say the United States is invading South Vietnam, as it was.
The best political leaders are the ones who are lazy and corrupt.
If the Nuremberg laws were applied, then every post-war American president would have been hanged.
The Bible is probably the most genocidal book in our total canon.
Education is a system of imposed ignorance.
There's no more morality in world affairs fundamentally than there was in the time of Genghis Khan. They're just different, you know, they're just different factors to be concerned with.
Now, Chomsky, thank you.
Well, you know, people will quite reasonably expect to know what you mean.
Why did you say that? I never heard that before. If you said that, you better have a reason, you know, you better have some evidence. In fact, you better have a lot of evidence, because that's a pretty startling comment. You can't give evidence if you're stuck with concision, you know. That's the genius of this structural constraint. And in my view, if people like, say, Nightline and McNeil Lehrer and so on were smarter, if they were better propagandists, they would let dissidents on. Let them on more, in fact. The reason is that they would sound like they're from Neptune.
Then comes our special conversation on the Middle East crisis. Tonight's is with the activist, writer, and professor Noam Chomsky.
Again, there has been an offer on the table, which we rejected, an Iraqi offer last April,
to eliminate
their chemical and other unconventional arsenals if Israel were to simultaneously do the same.
But
I think that should be pursued as well.
Sorry to interrupt you. I have to end it there. That's the end of our time. Professor Chomsky, thank you very much for joining us.
Audio excerpts from a film called Manufacturing Consent, which runs for almost 3 hours. It's an amazing film. It, again, won 22 awards. It's been translated into a dozen languages. It appeared in more than 50 international film festivals. You cannot go wrong with this film, and we are offering it to you today. I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on listener-sponsored KPFA. We are offering it to you for a pledge of $20 a month over 6 months, or $120 at one time. $120 or more gets you Manufacturing Consent. This film, I watched it in preparation for today's program, in fact, for yesterday's program when we also offered it. And it's just, I'm learning so much. I mean, I feel like I know a fair amount about Chomsky and his politics and his criticism of the media and of foreign policy, but I'm learning a ton, and I highly commend this to you. And in the next 3 minutes, we're going to try and make $400 together, right, $400 together, because Michael Pineschi and Nancy Fleischer, Michael Pineschi in Concord and Nancy Fleischer in Sacramento, have put up a total of $400. And they are challenging you all out there to come up with the same amount. But they'll give their money happily only if you collectively come up with $400. So your dollars are doubled. And if you want the DVD of Manufacturing Consent, and this is very, very thought-provoking and sharp and incisive, a lot of controversial and very strong opinions expressed by Mr. Chomsky, really kind of jarring the brain and kind of getting us out of that conventional way of thinking that really so many media outlets, you might agree, encourages us to think in. There is so much on this DVD. You can also get, and by the way, the phone number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or 1-800-HEY-KPFA, easy way to remember it, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. We're also offering a combo pack, since Noam Chomsky has identified himself as an anarchist, is very interested in anarchism and libertarian socialism. We are offering a combo pack for a $250 pledge to KPFA. You get both the film Manufacturing Consent and the film, it's been very popular, this fund drive, No Gods, No Masters, A History of Anarchism in Three Parts. That film is so big, so long, that it goes for two DVDs. It occupies two DVDs. So you get three DVDs for a $250 pledge to KPFA, Manufacturing Consent, and No Gods, No Masters. What can one say about Noam Chomsky? He is, according to the Daily Beast, Chomsky's relevance has only grown with time. He's more prescient as years pass. The journalist Glenn Greenwald said, "There is no living political writer who has more radically changed how more people think in more parts of the world about political issues than Noam Chomsky." He's been called, of course, scathing and brilliant, a public intellectual engaged in a concerted and committed campaign to break the big lie of an increasingly consolidated authoritarian state that has embarked on global military destruction in the name, often, of humanitarian undertakings. If you call right now 1-800-439-5732, your dollars will be doubled by Michael in Concord and Nancy Fleischer in Sacramento. I can't resist. We have some more of this film to play for you. I know I'm taking a risk, but I'm counting on people to call even while this next excerpt is playing. Please call 1-800-439-5732. In this clip, he responds, does Noam Chomsky, to a question about what Chomsky means by intellectual self-defense.
I don't mean go to school, because we're not going to get it there. It means you have to develop an independent mind and work on it. Now, that's extremely hard to do alone. You know, the beauty of our system is it isolates everybody. Each person is sitting alone in front of the tube. You know, it's very hard to have ideas or thoughts under those circumstances. You can't fight the world alone. Some people can, but it's pretty rare. The way to do it is through organization. So courses of intellectual self-defense will have to be in the context of political and other organization.
I wonder if you can envision a time when people like myself, again, the naive people of this world, can again take pride in the United States. And is that even a healthy wish now? Because it may be this hunger for pride in our country that makes us more easily manipulated by the powers that you talk about.
I think you first of all have to ask what you mean by your country. Now, if you mean by the country, the government, I don't think you can be proud of it, and I don't think you could ever be proud of it. Or it couldn't be proud of any government. It's not our government. You know. And you shouldn't be. States are violent institutions. The government of any country, including ours, represents some sort of domestic power structure, and it's usually violent.
Referring back to your earlier comment about escaping from or doing away with capitalism, I was wondering what scheme, workable scheme, you would put in its place.
Well, I mean, I think that what used to be called centuries ago wage slavery is intolerable. I mean, I don't think people ought to be forced to rent themselves in order to survive. I think that the economic institutions ought to be run democratically by their participants, by the communities in which they exist, and so on. And I think basically through various kinds of free association.
Historically, have there been any sustained examples on any substantial scale of societies which approximated to the anarchist ideal?
There are small societies, small in number, that have, I think, done so quite well. And there are a few examples of large scale libertarian revolutions, which were largely anarchist in their structure. As to the first, small societies extending over a long period, I myself think the most dramatic example is perhaps the Israeli kibbutzim, which for a long period,
That's Noam Chomsky, and there's so much more in this film, Manufacturing Consent, 2 hours and 47 minutes of talks and debates and interviews and archival footage, wonderful visuals that I want you to enjoy and to learn from. And I'm C.S. Song alongside Sasha Lilly. This is the last 14 minutes. This fund drive will come to you asking for money to support Against the Grain in our regularly scheduled hours, right? Because we're on Monday through Wednesday from noon to 1 Pacific. And we have two wonderful thank you gifts. One is this film, Manufacturing Consent, which I think everybody should have and everybody should watch. And I'm not just saying that. I really believe it. For a $120 pledge to KPFA, which you can break down into 6 monthly installments of $20 each, if that makes you happier and it's more manageable for you, you get this film, Manufacturing Consent. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. And as I mentioned earlier, and you heard Noam Chomsky talking about his interest in anarchism and past anarchist organized anarchism-inspired societies. We are offering as a companion gift, No Gods, No Masters, A History of Anarchism in Three Parts. This is a documentary film on two DVDs, and you get three DVDs, right? You get those two DVDs plus the DVD of Manufacturing Consent for a $250 one-year pledge to KPFA, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. We did make that match of $400 put up by Michael in Concord and Nancy in Sacramento. Thank you so much. And you know what? We've got one more match to make this fun drive.
Okay,
Sasha, so this match
I'm
is...
I'm stealing myself.
You better, because it's $1,000.
Holy moly.
This match is $1,000. It's put up by three devoted listeners, apparently, and generous contributors, or generous potential contributors to KPFA. Nancy Wakeman in San Francisco, thank you so much, Nancy. Aram Hodes in Orinda, thank you so much, Aram. I hope I'm pronouncing your name right. And Warren Marr in Sebastopol. Thank you, Nancy, Aram, and Warren. And they have been so generous, but their generosity is conditional because they need you to come up with $1,000 collectively for us to actually make that $1,000 match. So really, the last person who calls to take us over the top essentially earns $1,000 for us. Or another way you could look at it is, and it's true, is that every dollar you give now is doubled by Nancy Aram and Warren. So 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. If you donate online at kpfa.org, that counts. That counts toward the match, kpfa.org. And there you can do a little quote shopping if you like to see what else has been offered this fun drive, which ends Friday. So really, there's no time to waste. If you want to give and you want to get, and if you want to get this amazing gift and you might want to give this as a gift to somebody whose mind might be blown by the kinds of analyses and critiques presented by Noam Chomsky in this film, Manufacturing Consent. I can actually think of no better gift for somebody who just, you know, consumes the mainstream media. And he's not just talking about corporate media. He's talking about establishment media, because you heard him talking about a PBS, you know, supposedly a nominally public media institution. He's saying that establishment media is slanted, is biased, has a certain kind of subservience to power, is, and you know, this is his claim, is complicit in genocide in certain cases. I mean, this is very, very powerful stuff, combustible stuff that a lot of media outlets would refrain from presenting, and we are presenting it. And if you appreciate that, give us a call at 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. $120 or more, Manufacturing Consent comes your way if you ask for it. $250 or more, No Gods, No Masters, and Manufacturing Consent. Two amazing films. And you've probably heard excerpts from No Gods, No Masters, the film about anarchism in this fund drive, including on Against the Grain, presented by my co-host, Sasha. So 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Sasha and I hear, not just from people in the Bay Area, but from people around the world, I mean, you know, I'm trying to be honest, that they love Against the Grain, that they care about it, that they listen to it, that they podcast it, that they go to againstthegrain.org to get stuff, that they tell people about it. You know, we have a Facebook page and we have a lot of followers or likers there. I'm not social media competent, and a Twitter page. So, you know, we hear a lot from people who really care and get a lot out of this program. Now we're asking you to give and get, continue to get Against the Grain, but get these amazing films, either Manufacturing Consent or No Gods, No Masters, or both. 22 awards given to this one film. Certainly one of the most successful films, documentary films ever made. And who doesn't want to hear from Noam Chomsky and the powerful counter-narratives he presents to the official, mainstream, sanitized commercial products that are current news and opinion? 1-800-439-5732. Give us a call. Every dollar you give is doubled.
It is, but it's only over the next 8 minutes, and we, at the top of the hour, will have to tell these three generous listeners that we didn't make the challenge if you don't respond, so we're hoping so much that you will. 1-800-439-5732. And of course, what you're really getting is this alternative to the mainstream media, this critical outlet that is KPFA. And if you're listening, I'm going to guess that that is something that's important to you, and you probably realize, since we say it all the time on the air, that, but it's true, that we are only able to do what we do because we're not beholden to corporate interests. And Noam Chomsky, in the film Manufacturing Consent, talks about how private interest entirely shape the media system and shape social control in the United States. And as an antidote to it, he says we need to act collectively and we need to support the alternative media. So I'm hoping you will heed his call and pledge what you can by calling 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. As C.S. said, it's not the last day of the fund drive, but it's the last day that Against the Grain will come to you during this fund drive. So we're kind of hoping that if you're able to, you'll give as generously as you can, because $1,000 is on the line, and we really do need your support. And one of the things Chomsky talks about in this documentary is how the insistence of the mainstream media on sound bites, on concision, basically to allow someone to voice an opinion for a couple sentences that's then spliced between advertisements, that allows the conventional wisdom to always predominate and critical, complex counter perspectives to be shut out. And what we do here on Against the Grain is just the opposite. We have this, the luxury of this long form program, an hour long, in depth on a topic, and we are not constrained. It allows us to explore complexity. And if that's something that you value, I hope you'll support it right now. 1-800-439-5732. And Noam Chomsky, America's most prominent intellectual, he revolutionized the field of linguistics before his 40th birthday, and they explore that in the film Manufacturing Consent. And in December, he will turn 90, and he's still going strong. And I think he is a model of what people on the left can aspire to. And it's inspirational. This is not a downer. Although as critical as he is of U.S. foreign policy and the media system, Manufacturing Consent is actually a really inspiring film. So I hope you will think about going to your phone right now and calling 1-800-439-5732, pledging $120 or more for Manufacturing Consent, or throwing in No Gods, No Masters for the discounted rate of $250 for both Manufacturing Consent and No Gods, No Masters, A History of Anarchism in Three Parts. But whatever you do, please do it now. We have 5 minutes left. $1,000 is on the line. It's a heck of a lot of money. Don't forget, your donation is tax deductible to the fullest extent allowed by law. Please call right now, 1-800-439-5732, or go to kpfa.org.
kpfa.org, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. This film, Manufacturing Consent, is not just a critique of the media. It's a critique of power. It's a critique of how power operates and what it does and its effect on ordinary people around the world and on people in this country, and what it means for our possible complicity in U.S. foreign policy and U.S. government policy domestically as well. 1-800-439-5732, razor sharp commentary. And if that's what you tune into Against the Grain for, kind of a commentary that really provokes you and makes you think in a different way and makes you see things in a different light and maybe allows you to explore something deeper, examine something deeper with the help of our guests. And, you know, our guests are often really brilliant, and we're so proud to bring you the kinds of voices that we do, then give us a call, support this kind of project, and to which Noam Chomsky has expressed support so many times, right? He's been on Pacifica so many times. He's been on KPFA so many times. But this film, it brings it all together. So you can hear this speech, and that's wonderful, and it's sort of might be time dated, but this is really timeless stuff. It's what we call evergreen stuff, and we really want you to have this content. Michelle in Kensington, thank you so much. She called James. Dexter Lee in Tiburon called thank you. Leslie Howard in Emeryville called thank you. Join Matthew Vasquez and Clovis. Thank you, Matthew. Join Lydia Blanchard in Santa Cruz. Thank you so much, Lydia. O'Neill Lagarde in Visalia. Oh, love to hear from Visalia. Thank you so much, Jack Perinella. I hope so, Paracella in Oakland. Thank you so much. We've got people pledging online at kpfa.org. Join them. Join a community. Join a community of people who want to engage in intellectual self-defense. And you heard Noam Chomsky say that intellectual self-defense can't be done alone. It can't be done by just you or me sitting isolated, consuming something. It's about us coming together and supporting outlets that will make your mind, expand your mind, and give you a kind of independence of mind. You heard him talk about an independence of mind, which in my opinion, independence of mind is very, very hard to attain in this media environment. If KPFA and Pacifica is important to you, getting beyond the sort of dependency on the banal and the conventional and the grinding meaninglessness of so much punditry out there, give us a call. 2 minutes left to make this match. Every dollar you give is still doubled. We have not heard from the phone room. Give us a call. Get a great gift. $120 pledge. 1-800-439-5732.
Pickup Manufacturing Consent. It's funny. It's insightful. It's provocative. It's educational. It would make a wonderful gift. If there are birthdays coming up this year, you want to give someone a present that is going to possibly just blow their mind. This is it. It is 2 hours and 47 minutes long. It's packed full of all these extras, including Chomsky's debate with William F. Buckley and with Michel Foucault. Could you ask for more? You can get that for $120 and up. Pledge to KPFA. Throw in No Gods, No Masters, which is just a brilliant and enlightening look at anarchism, but also the Paris Commune, the Mexican Revolution, the Spanish Revolution. $250 gets you that. But honestly, if you could only give $25 right now, I want you to do it right now. $1,000 is on the line. We have just over a minute to make it. We don't know if we made the match, and it's an all or nothing sort of situation. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. 1-800-439-5732. Keep this institution alive, which really functions quarter to quarter, but was founded in the late 40s by anarchists, anarcho-syndicalists like Noam Chomsky, in fact. And we are keeping the flame of radical, critical dissent, I guess that's an oxymoron there, alive, and we hope that you will do your part to keep it going, because without you, we can't be here. Our work here really is irrelevant if you are not out there supporting it the way you do with your donations. 1-800-439-5732 or 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Less than a minute to go, CS. I mean, sorry, less than actually 20 seconds left to go before the hour is up.
Yeah, we haven't heard from the phone room, but you know what? I'm going to make a pronouncement, because based on the number of cards I've gotten and the amount we've been raising online, I think we've made that match.
Oh,
so thanks
so.
To everybody
Thank
who
you
called.
So much.
You can
online
still keep calling. Yeah.